Okay, welcome to the Northeast Region Regional Advisory Council meeting for December 2019. We will get started. The process tonight will be that we present an item, then we ask questions from the RAC. We open it for questions if there's something they need to clarify from the public. Then we take comments from the RAC and also comments from the public, and that's what you have the cards. If you want to make a comment, you need to fill out a card. Then we have a new process where we have the online comments, and we will summarize how the comments came in the region and also statewide online. And then the board will discuss and take action on each agenda item as it's listed. Some of these topics, we appreciate everybody coming, and we know you're passionate about wildlife. I assure you, all the individuals up here, which are volunteers, do not do this unless they're passionate also. So it's very important to us that your comments, even though you may have a lot of emotion about it, they stay, goes over the line. I will just say your time is up, and I hope you appreciate that, but we need to keep this meeting business-like. So with that, I will ask the RAC for a motion to approve the agenda for tonight.
Now, I'll go ahead and make a motion that we approve the agenda as it is. This is Dan Abeda.
I second that motion, Natasha Haddon.
All in favor? Okay, unanimous. Thank you. Have you had an opportunity to look at the minutes from the last meeting? Are there any edits or suggestions that the RAC has? If none, I will accept a motion to accept the last meeting's minutes.
I'll make a motion to accept the last meeting's minutes.
Dan Abeda, again. You should probably do some introductions, Brett.
Yes, I will do that. Sorry. Okay, all in favor? It's unanimous. Okay, I will take a step back and start on the end with Mike and have the RAC members introduce themselves.
I'm Mike Smith. I represent the non-lethal wildlife users.
Natasha Haddon. I'm a wildlife biologist for BLM.
Richie Anderson, representing agriculture.
Miles Hamburg. I'm the regional supervisor for DWR in the Northeast region.
I'm Brett Prevedel. I represent the public at large, and I'm currently the chair of the RAC.
Daniel Davis, and I represent sportsmen.
And Dan Abeda, I represent the Ashley National Forest.
I'm Jamie Areve, I represent the Indian Tribe.
Unless anybody on the RAC has any issues they need to bring up, old business. Okay. Then I will turn the time over for a regional update from Miles, and then I will take a few moments and talk about a few issues.
Okay, we've had a pretty busy fall going on here at the Division of Wildlife, so take a few minutes just to go over some of the things that have been going on in some of our various sections. In our aquatic section, they've just completed building a fish screen above Pelican Lake. This will help keep carp and other undesirable fish out of Pelican Lake in the future. We've, as a lot of people know, that lake had been treated with rotenone to remove carp. Things are looking good down there. Our water quality is much better, so this will help keep that from being reinfested with carp into the future. At the same time, there's been another project that's been constructing silt ponds on the canals and enters into Pelican Lake. Again, that's to catch a lot of the sediment that's coming down there to keep the water quality in good shape, but you know, some of these lakes, like Pelican, we're losing storage capacity life of those lakes because of the amount of sediment that comes into them. So this is a good proactive approach that will benefit not only the aquatic resources there, but as well as the water users. With our law enforcement section this year, the caseload is a little bit lighter this fall, which is good news, I believe. We also like to share that Sergeant Randy Sheets has completed the canine training and has a canine here in the region. Already within just a couple months that canine's been here, they've been able to recover some evidence in a couple different cases already, so that's going to be a good tool for our law enforcement efforts this year. This year was kind of a strange year. We had a number of bear and cougar incidents, people encountering those, hunters encountering those out in the field during the hunts this fall, both cougars and bears, and so it was an increase this year over any year we've seen in recent past. So our law enforcement section is also in the middle of investigating a wildlife commercialization case here in the region, and so hopefully we'll be able to make some good headway on that here in the near future. In our outreach section, we have a new staff member. His name is Wes Smith. Wes Smith is our new outdoor recreation specialist. He'll be working on a lot of our wildlife recreation events, seminars, outdoor activities that way, as well as things like our walk-in access program. So we're excited to have Wes. He's been in the Vernal area for quite some time, or maybe your whole life, right?
Mostly.
Yeah, most of his life. So anyhow, we're excited to have Wes here, and this is just his first week. So on our wildlife section, a biologist will be beginning the postseason deer classification soon. That classification we try to do during the rut period. So that'll be ongoing, and any of the RAC members would like to participate with that, can reach out to one of our biologists and ride along. We also have deer captures scheduled here beginning in early December on the South Slope, the Book Cliffs, and then we'll also be catching deer over on the Current Creek unit. GPS radio collars will be placed on all these animals, looking at migration patterns, survival, number of other valuable data points that we use for a lot of our management activities. We'll also be collaring additional cougars in the Book Cliffs this winter. That's part of a cooperative study with USU that's looking at various things. One of the main things is looking at the whether or not bears are coming in and stealing cougar kills and requiring the cougars to kill more often. So those are a few of the things that will be a result of that study. BYU is still completing a fawn and calf survival study in the Book Cliffs, where we've had collared fawns and calf elk. The survival's been fairly poor this year. Fawn survival as of current has just dipped below 40%, and the calf survival is about 50% right now. And so far, the majority of the loss is due to predation, and most of that is cougar, and then followed by bears. Our habitat section is busy implementing a lot of watershed restoration projects in cooperation with a lot of our federal partners. There's several bullhog projects going on. Some of those are around Blue Mountain, Monument Ridge, and Atchee Ridge in the Book Cliffs. There's also several fire rehab projects that are ongoing, and then some other restoration activities in Rabbit Gulch, Lake Canyon, and Meadow Creek in the Book Cliffs. Take a minute to update the RAC on the Book Cliff Working Group. Just a quick history. This group was formed in response to a trend of low fawn and calf survival, but also as we capture deer and elk in the fall, those animals were experiencing a very poor body condition into the fall, which would indicate that they aren't getting the forage or the nutrition they need on their summer range. So we formed a group to look at some of these issues and try to come up with some solutions and find some of the causes. And one of the things that's been done is an analysis of the forage that's being produced on good and poor precipitation years, as well as the amount of usage that we have out in the Book Cliffs. And what we found is, at least in the area between Seepridge and Willow Creek, on a good year, we're basically breaking even. But on a dry year, We've got more demand for that forage out there than that's being produced. And so we started looking at what are some of the causes for that. And one of the big things are stray horses. We did a survey out there, and we have probably over 200 stray horses on the Bookcliff Summer Range. And if you take the horses out of the picture, it brings us much closer to balancing the demand versus the amount of forage available. So the group has identified a few things that they're wanting to address. One of them is the stray horses, also looking at wild horse numbers, looking at grazing distributions and if there's any improvements could be made there, water and vegetation enhancements to help spread some of these use demands. Predation, as I mentioned before, is something that's being looked at pretty closely, and then also potential hunt strategies to be able to work through some of these issues. So there's going to be much more research coming down the next year or so to help answer and further clarify some of these questions. And this group's going to be developing an action plan soon that will help guide some of these tasks and efforts here into the future. So I think that's the main things that I wanted to talk about. Turn over to Brett to bring up a couple other things.
Thanks, Miles. An update on the Wildlife Board meeting. If you remember, the topics that were on the agenda last time were the private fish ponds rules that went through our RAC without much controversy, and it was passed unanimous up there. And then the bighorn sheep plans that we had all the discussion on. They accepted our recommendations, and they're when we revised the wordage, what left our RAC, what the suggestions we had to the Wildlife Board, their motion was to approve the bighorn sheep plans with all of the suggestions from the Northeast region. So it went very well in that respect. And then the conservation permit audit was the only other topic that they had. It was kind of a light board meeting, so that was the summary of the Wildlife Board meeting. And then a couple issues I want to bring up that we have here in the region. One of them is the release of pheasants. It's an issue, became an issue here in the region, and it's also statewide, and there's some safety concerns coming up, and also some ethics. And I got to see that firsthand. I volunteered. And last thing Tanya said is, don't get shot. And I kind of laughed. And she wasn't joking. And so we've got to do something as a agency, because we've created a not very good situation where people are waiting for the releases to happen and competing and being, there's some safety issues. My truck got shot over before I parked, and so I didn't have time to get out of my truck, and I know that, and Tanya had the same issue, and so we're looking at solutions to that. I don't think anybody, if they saw what's going on right now, would approve of it. And so we're looking at putting birds out during the night, random times, just kind of keeping it secret. So it hasn't went as smooth as we'd hoped. We'd hoped it'd be a real positive deal. And it's I'm sure it has some positives, but it has a whole bunch of negatives right now. And would you like to add anything to that, Tanya? Or did I summarize that okay? So we're looking at options. We'd like to keep it, but in, you know, just my opinion, keeping it as is, I'd rather not have it than have what's happening now, just because of the safety issues that are coming out of it. But I think we'll come up with a middle ground somewhere and hopefully bring it back to a positive thing. The baiting issue, I know I've talked to several people in this room, and baiting of big game was initially going to be a topic this month, but the division felt they weren't quite prepared to move that forward right now. So if you want to talk about baiting, we can do that tonight. and we will do it in number six with the bucks, bulls, and the hunting regulations. And then there won't be specific action on the baiting issue tonight, but it's still on the table for discussion, and we could, if we wanted as a RAC, we could make whatever recommendation towards the Wildlife Board on that topic after tonight. So with that, I believe we'll move into the agenda. One more time on the process. If anybody wants to comment on a subject, you need to fill out one of these green cards and bring it up, and we will call you by name. We don't have a huge amount of comments here, but we'll try to limit it to 3 or 4 minutes of constructive comment tonight. Okay. Covey Jones is here to present the statewide deer management plan.
Using rod so close together.
I know.
Yeah, it's nice.
Working on our exercise here.
Got a pointer? Wow. I cannot see that from here. Glad I have the screen in front of me. All right. My name is Kobe Jones, Mr. Chair. I'm here to present the 2019 Mule Deer Management Plan. Starting with whenever we write one of these plans, it's our goal to get a diverse group of constituents. When we're talking about mule deer management, there are a lot of right ways to manage mule deer, right? It's the division's job to step in and say what ways could be biologically damaging. There are a lot of right and good ways. There's a lot of opinions about how the public wants to see their mule deer managed. So whenever we write a management plan, we form a committee with a diverse group of constituents. And that's exactly what we did here. Now, there's a couple things when we form these committees that we ask the members, or we let the members know. One, we ask them to commit to come to every meeting. And if they don't commit, they're allowed to have one substitute to come and represent their constituency. That's the first thing. Another one is, They understand that their role is to be advisory to the division, and that our goal is to work hard to come to consensus and write a plan that we can all agree upon. But at the end of the day, it's the division's job to make recommendations through this public process that are then modified by RACs presented to the Wildlife Board, and that is what is adopted. With this committee and this group of individuals, we're able to write a plan where we did come to consensus on issues. That doesn't mean that we all agreed. There are a lot of things that the committee disagreed on, and there was give and take and push and pull and different perspectives. You know, we had private landowners, federal and state land management agencies, our partners. We had elected officials, RAC and board members, general sportsmen that weren't affiliated with any groups. And we took all those perspectives. Also, we had researchers and scientists on the committee as well. Look out for the academic aspect of mule deer management. And this was a good committee. We were able to go through a lot of research. We were able to go through a lot of our new data. And we were able to come to consensus. We held 8 meetings on the committee. We started in March 5th, all the way through September 5th. And we spent over 30 hours together. The division representative from the committee, he's sitting here in the back, Derek Yule. It was a lot of time together. I like Derek. That was probably a little too much time. We're proposing this plan as a 7-year plan. In the past, these have been 5-year plans from 2019 to 2026. And the reason why we're doing that is because these efforts take a lot of time. The one thing is, if you're always changing the meters or the metrics you're trying to manage to, you never know if you were successful. And in Utah, we change and tweak a lot. We're really reactive on permit numbers. We're really reactive. If you were in New Mexico, for example, they set permit numbers for 4 years for mule deer. They don't touch them. Right? We adjust, we change every year. But we need to know if our management's headed in the direction that we want it to go. And so extending that 2 more years helps us do that. The other reason why is because there's only so many hours in a day. And whenever we write one of these plans, it takes a significant amount of effort, a lot of time on behalf of the division. And whenever we're doing that, we're sacrificing other things. Right? So we can either spend more time doing good things for deer or spend more time writing a plan. And we'd rather extend that out a few more years. Some of the topics that we covered, we started with issues and concerns and what is working well. So we started with the committee and we said, all right, what's broken? What do we want to see change? What do we want to fix? And there were some things they wanted biologists to be able to be a little more reactive to conditions. And so we put some language in there and some strategies in there to do that. And we'll go through those. So what is working well? What don't we want to see change? And a lot of the structure that we hunt mule deer under, the committee didn't want to see change. Neither did the public. So that was the next step. After we go through what's working well, what do we want to see change, and we checked all that with a survey on Utah's hunting public. So we randomly surveyed 9,300 individuals that either put in for a point or purchased a deer tag the previous year. And of that, we got about just over 2,000 responses. 22% responded. And we used that to check what the committee felt. If the committee felt pretty strongly about something and they were headed down a road that was completely contrary to what the public survey said, we'd say, well, this might be something that represents your constituency, but overall the general public feels this way. Can you see that point of view or can you understand that? It was just a good check to make sure that we were trying to do what the public wanted as well. After that, we started into the goals of the plan. So we've got 3 goals, a population goal, a habitat goal, and a recreation goal. And then we have objectives and strategies. So the goal is where we want to be at the end of the plan. And then the objectives and strategies, especially the strategies, that's how we're going to get there, what the methods are that we're going to use to get there. And so in this presentation, that's what we'll go through, is what the goals are and what new strategies we've put in place to help us accomplish those goals with the population, habitat, and recreation. And finally, for the first time ever in Utah, we are going to take a stab at trying to manage chronic wasting disease. And we wrote this as an appendix to the plan. One of the reasons that we did that is because, frankly, there's a lot we don't know about chronic wasting disease. There's some things we do know. We know it's not good, and we'll get into some of that in the presentation as well. There's a lot we don't know. And writing it as an appendix allows us to add the latest science when we need to and it becomes available and not open the plan or change the plan. Starting with the population management goal. So we want to expand and improve mule deer populations throughout the state and within carrying capacities of available habitats. We want more deer where we can have more deer, right? I think that's what our public wants, that's what we wanted, that's what the committee wants, it lines up. So the objective then is to manage mule deer populations within the state as conditions allow and bring all populations to their unit objectives. In 2019, that objective is 453,100. So that's what we're aiming for right now if we look at the unit plans. And that objective is a summary of the unit plan objective. So we don't set the statewide population objective in the statewide plan. It's just a summary of all the unit objectives. And we'll go into that too. But unit plans, they deal with how we grow more deer and how we address limiting factors. And the statewide plan is more guidance to those unit plans and how we hunt bucks. So just to look back at where we've been and where we are. In the early 90s, I think everybody's aware, we had a pretty good deer crash. We dropped 250,000 deer. Through the early 2000s, that number went back and forth. It stayed right around that 300,000 mark of a modeled population. And then about 2012, 2013 through 2016, we had some really good conditions to grow deer. We had mild winters, we had precipitation at the right times, we had a lot of food on the landscape, we had fat deer, we had a lot of fawns, we grew a lot of deer. In 2016, we know that at that point we had a rough winter. That was the first drop off, followed by severe drought and another more severe winter last year. Two out of the three winters have been more severe with a drought in between. And we've seen the impacts on mule deer. We've fallen off that peak. It's not a surprise to us. As you look at models, you know, and this is one thing that the RAC last night brought up, is how do you know that's the exact number? We don't know that that's the exact number. In fact, we know that that number's wrong. There aren't exactly 372,000 deer in the state of Utah right now. What we do know is that models are really good at predicting trend over time. Right? We also know that they smooth, right? So that means that the peak in 2016, we probably underestimated the number of deer on the landscape. And the fall off, that's probably underestimated as well. Right? So as we watch that trend over time, it'll smooth, but it gives us a good indication of abundance on the landscape, not the exact number. So for the population objective continued, this is where we give some direction to the unit plans. So we direct biologists to set realistic and attainable unit objectives. We tell them there's some new tools and some new things we have. So we say, here's what we're going to base population objectives on. First of all, base it on body condition of the deer, right? For a long time, we based population objectives on habitat and on other things that were indicators of possible body condition. Since 2013, we've started a major collaring effort. Every year, you know, we have between 500 and 800 mule deer in hand. When we do that, we use ultrasounds and other methods to determine body fat, which allows us to then extrapolate to body condition. And the data is coming in now to where we've got a pretty good idea based on how fat deer are and where they are in the state, at what rate they're going to survive. So we can look at a deer, and the example that I can think of right now is, last year, the unit slips my mind. I've got a million units in my mind all the time, but you know, last year we went and caught on some CWs in northern Utah, and when those deer came in, we knew they were too skinny. So we caught deer in December, and we knew that we had dead deer walking. They came in too skinny. The drought had too severe of an effect on those deer. And sure enough, we ended up with low 30% survival for adults. We've never seen that before. That is the lowest adult survival that we've ever seen on the landscape. And we knew it in December. We didn't know how bad the winter was going to be. We knew that deer herd was in trouble. So base population objectives on body condition. What that really means is, do you have enough habitat? Deer density dependent. Do you have enough good forage for those deer? Also, to evaluate cause-specific mortality. And I've spent a lot of time talking about habitat. We also have populations, and we have areas where deer are in good body condition, but the population still isn't growing. And so there are bottom-up effects, which are habitat effects, right? And there are what we call top-down effects. And for a long time, I think you heard, well, we're learning more and more all the time. And biologists said, well, you know, mountain lions or predators probably don't have that much of an impact on mule deer. And the truth is, sometimes they don't. But sometimes they do. With current data, we're seeing that there are units where we have fat deer, we have good fawn production, and then because of cause-specific mortality, because we collar a bunch of deer, and every time one of those deer die, we have a biologist out there on the ground within 48 hours. They look at the deer, they look at what killed the deer, and they can, hello, Brad. How are you?
Good.
Sweet. So they look at the deer, they look at what killed the deer, and then they're able to tell, okay, on this unit we have fat deer, we have good fawn production, but it appears we probably have a predator issue, probably have some top-down regulation. So that's another thing we want a biologist to evaluate when they're setting a population objective. Do we have room to grow? And what is the cause of mortality here? Is it roads? Is it predators? We still have to take into account range trend. And Range Trend is a data set that Utah's had since the 40s. It provides us with an indication of what our deer ranges look like and what they'll sustain. Also to look at historical population estimates and to look at production. Again, production is an indication of your body condition. So the next directive we have is to manage mule deer below carrying capacity to improve overall health and increase herd productivity. Right? So we want healthy fat deer on the landscape, as many healthy fat deer on the landscape as we can have. And managing below carrying capacity will allow us to have more healthy herds. And to use antlerless harvest as a primary tool to manage deer populations. So this is one where I think that, you know, everybody here hears that and says, well, the division's talking about doe hunts. And the truth is, yes. In wildlife management, our goal is to, at times, shave off the peaks so that we can have the valleys not be as low, right? And the truth is, we haven't done that very good at deer. We are really good at habitat restoration. We're really good at improving the size of the box. You know, if you think about mule deer, if they're in a box, you have a bigger box, you can hold more deer. So we're really good at habitat work. Habitat work improves the size of the box. But one of the things that we've struggled with socially is to be able to harvest does when we need to, when we see that a herd's in poor body condition. And what that leads to is a lot of oscillation in populations, right? We grow, we hit a peak, we pass carrying capacity, we have a hard winter, we crash, we fall. We fall down low, conditions change, we get conditions that are conducive to growth, we grow again, we hit a peak, we crash again. We're really good at managing deer when we're below carrying capacity. We know what to do. We back off, we wait for them to respond, they come back. But what we're not really good at is managing deer when we're growing. When we're growing, and a lot of times because of social pressures, we overshoot that carrying capacity and end up in a crash. So the plan with the new data that we have on body condition says, let's look at this and more actively manage deer. Finally, manage CWD in accordance with the CWD plan, and we'll go into that later in the presentation. So we wanted to check some of these assumptions with the public survey, and so we asked the public, would you support doe hunts in deer populations that are in poor herd health? And surprisingly, we're at 81% of the general public would support that, general hunting public. So we asked again, you know, would you support doe hunts to prevent poor herd health? And 65% of the general hunting public would support that. Then we got really brave and we said, hey, would you support doe hunts for the opportunity to harvest meat? And again, 50% of the general hunting public would support that. Now, I don't want everybody to panic and think the division's calling a bunch of doe hunts, because we're not. But what we want to do is try to more actively manage deer and have healthier herds. Under the habitat goal. So the habitat goal, conserve, improve, and restore mule deer habitat throughout the state with an emphasis on crucial ranges. There are really two components to this, objective one and objective two. Objective one is to maintain mule deer habitat throughout the state by protecting and enhancing crucial habitats. So first, maintain what we have. And second, improve the quality of vegetation for deer on a minimum of 700,000 acres over the life of this plan. So maintain what we have first, and improve areas that aren't that good second. That's growing the box. You know, where we see that deer in poor health, the other part of this would be to look at habitat projects that will address that and increase herd health and herd productivity. Some of the strategies, or the how we're going to do that, we want to identify, map, and characterize crucial mule deer habitats, including migration routes. So in addition to the collaring effort that started in 2013, we started another collaring effort 3 years ago to add additional mule deer collars on the landscape and look at what are the most important areas, what areas are they using, what areas should we improve, what areas should we target, and again, find out more of what cause-specific mortality looks like at a statewide level. Also, to identify and rank threats and limiting factors within each unit plan, to work with municipalities and counties to minimize and mitigate the loss of crucial mule deer habitat, migration corridors, and to support the Watershed Restoration Initiative, support and provide leadership for. And the Watershed Restoration Initiative is the machine with which the division is able to accomplish the habitat restoration that we do at the scale that we do. So on to recreation. We found in the public survey, as well as with the committee, that there was a lot of desire to maintain what we currently had in the state, to maintain a limited entry system and a general season system, maintain a diversity of high-quality hunting and viewing opportunities, and not to have a lot of change in this area. And so the first objective is to maintain mule deer hunting that encourages a variety of quality hunting opportunities while maintaining population objectives. And number two is to increase opportunities to educate the public about the needs of mule deer and the importance of habitat and other limiting factors. We do have a diversity of hunting in Utah. And I know a lot of people feel a lot of different ways, but I really like it. I like the fact that you can hunt deer on a general season unit quite often, and you can still put in for a limited entry unit and dream about hunting a big buck or an area with more quality. I think we're doing a good job there. Where I think we struggle is on recreation objective two. We are doing a lot for deer. We are doing more for deer and have more data and are more actively managing deer than we ever have. And we don't do a great job sometimes at sharing that with the public. What we're doing, how we're doing it, what's changed, what we're learning, what we're doing better. And we need to do a better job at that. And I hope to throughout the life of this plan. Jumping into the recreation strategies, we'll highlight the changes here, the things that have changed. The things that stayed the same are still managed for 15 to 17 or 18 to 20 bucks per 100 does. The same 11 units at 15 to 7, the same 18 units at 18 to 20. And then we give some direction to biologists on what they should consider when making a recommendation. So the first few things here are things that we've always considered. Look at your buck doe ratio. Look at your current estimate, 3-year average and trend. But we added another one here. With all the data that we have on adult and fawn survival and understanding that a lot of these general season units or general season units are driven by the fawn crop that comes in that year, biologists will now take a hard look at adult and fawn survival and use that to more actively manage buck permits. The next directive, one of the things that we hear is that we don't increase or decrease as fast as the public would like to see, especially decrease, frankly. But the next objective addresses that. And it says permits will be recommended to achieve the management objective. So before, the way this was written, it says permits will be recommended to make progress toward the management objective, right? And over the course of a 5-year plan, what we saw is that there were several units in the state where we never achieved the objective. So in trying to make progress towards the objective, and this was mostly at providing the opportunity to the public that we could have, and we never made it. Never offered the increase in permits that we could have. And this is on a lot of the southern region units. So for example, on the Pine Valley, we're still sitting mid-20s on the buck doe ratios and have a lot of opportunity left on the table there. I think that folks a lot of times think that the deer is something you can put on a shelf and save, right? You grow deer, you grow big bucks, you put them on a shelf, you save them, and then you're able to harvest them throughout the years, and that's just not the way it works. We need to hunt deer when we have deer because we won't always have deer. So if there's one thing that we look back on in the last plan that we didn't meet, between 2013 and 2016, we grew 100,000 deer. And we only increased 3,000 to 4,000 permits. now we're in an area where we're going to have to cut permits, and we know that. We know we're going to have to cut permits this year. We don't have to cut permits moving forward. And so it's really a kind of a tragedy. We didn't offer that opportunity to our hunting public when we had good numbers. And this strategy will help us do that. Hunter recreation strategies continued, and this time is looking at limited entry. So a lot of this is the same here. Manage limited entry units for $25 to $35 per 100 does. One change is at the very bottom, where we gave biologists an indication of where they should be managing. So 25 to 35, they could have been anywhere inside of that. And what we said is aim for the middle, aim for 30. If we're above, that's okay. If we're below, that's okay. But aim for 30. So it's just some direction on where we should try to manage to. On a premium limited entry, there was no desire by the committee or the public to touch these two units. Left them alone. So as long as you're meeting the management objectives, these permits are locked in, right? As long as you're at $40 to $55 per 100 does, and greater than 40% of the bucks harvested in the limited entry portion are at least 5 years old or older, we'll maintain 49 public draw permits on the Henrys and 135 public draw permits on the Ponsagon. If you drop below that 5 year, that 40% are at least 5 years old or older, you could see a reduction in permits on these units, but you won't see, and when they returned, you'd see them go back to the original levels of 49 and 135, but not increased above that. Also, there's a strong sentiment to continue to provide management buck hunts, and this is exactly the same as the last plan, at a minimum of 10 on each unit. And those are some misconceptions in management buck hunts and why we have them. It is not a genetic call. It has nothing to do with that. It has to do with the fact that we have surplus bucks on these units. There are times when we're above that 55 or approaching that 55 bucks per 100 does. And this is to help manage that ratio a bit and provide some opportunity on bucks that probably wouldn't get harvested by the limited entry hunters. For the season dates, the change here is the recommendation to add the 9-day late muzzleloader season as a limited entry opportunity on all general season units. And this was highly supported by the committee, but there was one individual on the committee that didn't support the recommendation. And he said, I can support it if we'll make it fair and consistent across the state. And what he didn't want to see is some units have 30 of these, and some units have 2, and some units have 100. So if we can be fair and consistent across the state and base it on something, tie it back to the unit, that's something I can support. And so as a committee, we came up with this, that the permits would be equal to 0.5% of the total general season draw permits or 5 permits. If they don't meet that 5 permits, they would go to 5 permits. So the Thousand Lakes, extremely low permit numbers, just be 5 permits. But if you look at the Manti, the biggest unit in the state, at 0.5%, that would offer approximately 40 permits on that unit. Not a lot of permits, but when you add it all together, it was a way for the division to offer to the public a limited entry opportunity without decreasing the number of general season units or increasing the number of limited entry units. Altogether, this adds about right over 400 permits. So to the whole state, it adds about another Buck Cliffs unit. Some of the strategies continued. Continue to evaluate areas for limited entry hams hunts. And these are the hunts that we brought before the board and racks last year. They're handgun, archery, muzzleloader, shotgun hunts. And this is Utah's attempt at a primitive weapon. So these are all iron sights, handgun, archery, muzzleloader, shotgun, iron sights, no scopes. Continue to look at areas to provide these opportunities, areas with low deer densities, underutilized by hunters, high potential for human conflict, or in areas of migratory deer populations that you don't hunt during the regular seasons, and to continue to evaluate areas for new extended archery units. One strategy that I'm excited about, and this is one that we didn't make a lot of progress on in the last one, is to work with the Mammals Program Coordinator, have spot and stock cougar permits that overlap deer seasons. So in areas where we know we have some of that top-down regulation, we know we have a predator issue, to work with the Mammals Program Coordinator to implement possibly some of these hunts where you could hunt a lion and a deer at the same time. And the committee felt like with all of the point creep in general season that they needed to support losing preference points if a hunter acquires a buck deer permit. For outreach and recreation strategies, work with our partners to increase outreach efforts to promote mule deer conservation. And the next strategy used to say use things like kiosks and print media, and we brought this into this entry and said, you know, let's use electronic media, let's use Facebook, let's use things like that to get our message out there and work to convey this to the public. All right, chronic wasting disease. I'm not a vet, I'm not a pathologist, I'm not a chronic wasting disease expert. We have one of those, she's not here. I'll do my best, and if you have questions, I'll do my best to answer it. There's a few things we know about chronic wasting disease. It's a nervous system disease, right? And it's caused by prions. It's caused by malformed proteins, right? So your DNA, your genetic code says, all right, here's what your protein chain should look like, and it forms those. And these prions, they're right in the primary structure, right? Your chains are right. They're right in the secondary structure. But then when they fold upon themselves in what they call the tertiary structure, they fold wrong. When they fold wrong, they tell the proteins next to them, hey, you're folded wrong. And when they change conformation, it leads to an animal that has holes in its brain, and it ends up dead, right? Chronic wasting disease is always fatal. It's spread through contact with saliva, feces, carcass parts, and contaminated environments. It is highly stable. It will get into the soil. It will get into plant material. And once you have it in an area, just trying to think if there's, you cannot get it back out. There's nowhere that I'm aware of where they've got it back out after they've got it in an area. We do not want more of this in our state, right? Since 2003, we've had 94 deer test positive, and this number is wrong. We've had three more since then. So we've had 97 deer and two elk test positive. Currently, it's found in six wildlife management units on the South Slope, in the central portion of the state on the Manti and Nebo, and on the LaSalle's. And currently, we estimate that it's about 1 to 5% prevalence in those units. That's a good thing, right? There are areas in Colorado, areas in Wyoming where they're approaching 50% prevalence. Because this is always fatal, every deer that contracts this will die. It's becoming impossible or very difficult for them to grow mule deer. Before they can hunt them, before a lion takes them, before anything happens to them, half of them are just gone. So what the plan proposes is that we use rotational sampling clusters, so 2 to 3 units, and that we move through the state every 5 years and sample the whole state. What we want to do with this is first slow the spatial spread of CWD, right? We don't want it to move into new areas. We want to prevent further increase in CWD positive areas, and that means prevalence, right? Right now we're at 1 to 5%. In the LaSalle's, probably closer to that 5%. Manti out here, probably closer to that 1%. Don't want that to increase, and detect newly infected areas as soon as possible so that we can start to manage those areas. So here are some of the ways that we can manage CWD. So manage CWD positive units for a lower buck doe ratio. So bucks, especially prime age bucks, are about twice as likely to have this disease. bucks from ages 4 to 6 are about twice as likely to have this disease. Now, I don't know why. I don't know if anybody knows why. There's some thoughts. One of the thoughts is that they're doing most of the breeding and that they are more social. They're moving from group to group and have more opportunities to have this disease. After a buck gets past the age of 6 or under the age of 4, it's less likely to have it. So 4 to 6, more bucks 4 to 6 have it. So if you manage for a lower buck doe ratio, you have fewer prime age bucks on the landscape. That's one way to manage it. Another way is to have late season buck hunts targeting prime age class bucks. And none of these are current recommendations from the division. They're in the plan and they could be recommendations coming forward. Another one is in an area where we have a hot spot, we may want to lower the population density. I said it's more prevalent in bucks, but it also persists in does. And lower density means lower frequency of contact and less of a chance to spread it. Restrict the import of whole carcasses from CWD-positive states. We already do this. The way it's written now in rule is that it's restricted from positive units. Wildlife management units are counties. So this really is just to simplify it. If you're hunting in Colorado, if you're hunting in Wyoming, bring in boned out meat, hide, skull caps. Don't bring in the whole animal. We don't want the brain matter. We don't want the spinal cord. That's how this is spread. To limit the translocation of service to the largest extent possible, we don't want to be responsible for moving a CWD positive deer into a new area because they can be asymptomatic, right? About a 2-year period contact to the time they die, so they might not show any symptoms at all. You move it, later you find out you moved a CWD positive deer. To prohibit rehabilitation of cervids. In the states that allow high fence hunting, this is a real problem. Now, when we talk about prevalence rates of 1 to 5% in areas of highly concentrated animals inside a high fence, it's way over 50%, way, way higher than that. We don't want to get there. And then to limit baiting and feeding. So to summarize the plan, this plan provides guidance and direction for managing Utah's mule deer populations. Overall, a lot of minor changes. More active population management and more tools for biologists. Again, this mule deer recommendations for the next 7 years will be made in accordance to this plan. And just another thanks to the committee. Everybody that spent a lot of hours on this worked together, and we appreciate that time and that effort. That's all.
Thanks, Kobe. I will now entertain questions from the RAC regarding this presentation. Jamie?
My question is on the just some clarification on the CWD transport. Is it illegal to move it within the state of Utah from an area that's infected to another area that's not infected?
That is a really good point. And we've had that brought up at a few other RACs because we have infected areas inside the state. Currently, as it's written, it is not illegal. And what we've run into is that if you're in the whole state of Colorado, right, you can move your deer around. You can get to a taxidermist that can beetle your skull or do whatever you need to do. And that's easier. But if you're on the LaSalle's, you might not be able to find a meat processor on that unit. So what we've elected to do is to educate the public. If you're hunting these units, if you're hunting LaSalle's, the Manti, the areas that have it, here's how you should properly dispose of the spinal cord, the brain matter, and here are some proper ways. And so instead of making that illegal, we feel like it's probably a better match to educate our public on that.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Yeah, Brett, I've got a question. Yeah. What's that? Dan Abeda.
Kobe, not really got questions so much on this presentation, but it's kind of related. What month does the division present the unit numbers to the RAC? What month does that discussion happen through the RAC process? The unit by unit numbers, like population,
objectives and estimates and stuff like that.
So when do unit deer plans go through the RAC process?
Yes, that's the question.
We brought those through both in this RAC and in the spring RAC. Sometimes it just depends on what's going on, but it's always in the big game RAC. So we bring them through on a 5-year rotational basis. So each region will bring theirs through every 5 years. And it's either this RAC or the spring RAC usually.
Okay, thanks.
And then the permit numbers are then annually, I believe, in April.
Yeah.
Is that right?
They're always annually in April. But as far as unit plans,
yeah,
we haven't stuck to the same RAC consistently with those.
Okay, thanks.
Yep.
Any other questions from the RAC? Would the public like anything clarified? You don't need a card to ask a question. Just come to the mic and state your name.
Hi, I'm Jerry Slaw. I did have some questions, and just in watching that, and I was writing them down here, so hopefully I can get through them decent. But we're talking, you know, in the mule deer management plan, fat, healthy deer, you know, and what makes them healthy, and obviously there's multiple things, right? So my question was, are does in the first estrus cycle, are they better? Is it better for them to be bred when they hit their first estrus cycle? Or, because I know there's 2 or maybe 3, I don't know. So is it healthier, is what I'm asking, for a doe to be bred when she first comes into heat versus if she misses and goes to the second one?
So that question, I think that most of your deer align to come into estrus, that first estrus, at the time when, on average, they would drop that fawn at the best time. So the answer is, on average years, yes.
It's best for them to be bred when they first go into the cycle. So yes. The mule deer gestation period is about 205 days?
Yeah.
Something like that. So if a deer is bred November 1st, that deer would drop at the end of May, May 20th. That is basically the calculation. So if it's healthier, is what you're saying, if it's healthier for a deer to drop in June because the winter is really bad in May, she'll hold on?
Well, no.
No, I mean.
So it's more complicated than this.
Okay.
But I need to, what exactly is it that you're trying to get at? I'm trying to understand.
I'm wondering if it's better for the herd to manage for all does to be bred during their first cycle, which usually continues from November 1st to mid-November. But we know the breeding goes on into December. So I'm wondering if 15 to 17, and that was my next question,
okay,
is 15 to 17 bucks
is enough to
able that. To get that done in the doe in the first part of November?
Okay, so that's a good question.
Is what I'm asking. So I'm just, I was trying to.
Okay, so what is good is synchronous partition, right? So, I mean, regardless of when it happens,
mm-hmm,
the more synchronous the partition, the better chance you have to swamp the predators. And that is what mule deer try to do. Let's get them all out on the same day, around the same day range, so that we have a better chance of some surviving. Now, there is good data. You know, there were 2 studies published on this, and I can get them to you after you'd like to, about the synchrony of partition, because I've heard this a lot. Well, you only need $5 to $7 to breed all the does on the landscape. $5 to $7 per 100 does breeds every doe. But the argument, and even some school of thought among biologists, is, well, that leads to partition that isn't very synchronous. What we do know is there's been 2 research articles published that show that at the rates they evaluated a unit in Colorado, I think it was about 25, they evaluated a unit in Utah, they evaluated Monroe, and at the time, I can't remember if it was 17, 18, somewhere in there, but it was lower. And the lower buck doe ratio actually had a more synchronous partition than the higher buck doe ratio.
Based on the study.
Based on that study.
That they're saying.
And there isn't a peer-reviewed study that contradicts that right now.
Okay. And that's why I'm asking. In my mind, perfect. It would seem that when that happens, that would be the... what percentage of fawns usually need to survive to grow? I know that's a broad question. If there's 100 does and 40 of the fawns survive, are you shooting for 40%? Are you shooting for 75%?
Okay.
Are you shooting for 100? You know, most does have twins or what? Are we trying to go for 100%? So, you know what I'm saying? What usually number causes the herd to grow?
Okay. So you can evaluate this just by looking at what numbers you'd have to have a positive lambda. West-wide average for mule deer survival is 85%. So on average, 85% adult doe survival. So if you assume that it's average, if you have 85% adult doe survival, you hope to have 60 fawns per 100 does in the fall when you do your classification. If you're at 85% adult doe survival and 60 fawns per 100 does, you can lose 50% of those over the winter and have a slightly positive lambda or about break even, right? If your adult doe survival starts to drop off for any reason, so every 1% decrease in adult doe survival means you need to increase by 3 fawns per 100 does in order to make that up. So at 84, you need 63, 83, 66. So the problem is if you're starting to cut into your adult doe survival, your fawns aren't going to survive better. And so, but those are the magic numbers.
Yeah, right? That's what I'm looking for, magic number. I know there's
that's the magic number. And again, it's more complicated than that, but if you have 85%, 60 fawns per 100 does, you can lose half of them, and you could have a slightly positive lambda. And what I mean by that is slightly positive population growth.
So, okay, perfect. And so, last thing, the collared deer,
yeah,
is that public information that you can get somewhere? I've seen more collared deer this year than I had, so I'm like, I'm curious if that's public information, if I can...
Some of it is. So survival rates and things like that, we try to get those out. We email those to all the RAC members, and we're developing a website right now. BYU is developing a website and partner with the division to be able to give that data live to sportsmen so you can see what survival rates look like. Location data, however, is protected, and that's under state code.
Okay. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, and I would like to add on that. I believe on the deer captures, they're... which they do in December, aren't you finding 100% pregnancy rate on the does?
It's always high. It's always 95 to 98%.
Okay, so
not 95% that they've bred that year.
Yes, just I understand your question. I just wanted to throw that out that from a population standpoint, it's almost 100%.
Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions from the public? If not, we'll move to comments from the RAC. Okay. Any comments? I have one I'll start it with. Joe had some issues, Joe Arnold, RAC member, and he couldn't make it. And he asked me to mention to you that he would like to see a trend of moving some of the better quality limited entry hunts towards premium hunts where the point creep is such that it takes 15 years to draw out anyway. He felt, even though it would have an impact on that waiting a few more years for a tag, and he used the book cliffs as an example, and I know that one's kind of a hot topic right now, but he would like to see maybe another category there just between the premium hunts and the limited entry with a higher buck to doe ratio to improve the quality. Any comments? Any other comments? Okay. We have a few comments from the public. How about Kenyon from the Mule Deer Foundation? Would you start, please? Please state your name.
I'm Ken Powell with the Mule Deer Foundation. I'll just read what I have to say. It'd be the easiest way to do it. I'm Ken Powell. I'm a member of the High Desert Leadership Team of the Mule Deer Foundation. Thank you, RAC, for the opportunity to comment. Thank you, Covey, for their presentation. Mule Deer Foundation was represented in the statewide Mule Deer Committee from the regional director, Jeremy Anderson, who couldn't make it tonight. Jeremy asked me to give approval and support for the Mule Deer Foundation for the entirety of the management plan. I also got the opportunity, along with other volunteer leaders across the state, for the MDF to hear the plan and was asked to pick it apart a couple weeks back with Covey and other members of the division. It was great to get clarification on many items that I was unclear of or didn't particularly care for. Even with our leadership group, there were disagreements, but this is the type of plan and so many moving parts. We trust in the DWR to make their own new technology of coloring, that this plan is the best for our future. I approve this plan as presented. Thank you. Now, I want to just say one thing as a personal person, as Ken Powell, not with the Mule Deer. You're talking about doing the does and harvesting them does, and you're doing all these extended archery permits. I feel that we should move that into November as doe only in them areas so we can help manage the deer population. Thank you.
Thank you. Blake, would you like to speak next?
Thank you, Brett. Blake Bess, representing the sportsman, dedicated hunter myself. Tonight I'd like to address the RAC. I believe in northeastern Utah, the seven-year plan is too long with our harsh winters. A lot can change in 7 years in northeastern Utah. After last winter, our deer herd health in northeastern Utah is not good, with a poor survival rate of fawns. I disagree with these doe hunts, especially for northeastern Utah. I disagree with your buck-to-doe ratio. If you only have 100 does left, but you got your 18 bucks, what good do they do you? Let's get the population numbers up, and Mother Nature will take care of herself. I encourage the RAC to discontinue the late muzzleloader deer hunt on the South Slope Yellowstone unit. I've hunted this unit the last 3 years as a dedicated hunter, and I've never pulled the trigger on nothing in the 3 years on public land. Hunting all days of the muzzleloader and rifle hunts all 3 years. This unit is beyond in trouble, and I believe it's time this RAC stands up and does something. This spring, I encourage the RAC to encourage the Wildlife Board to lower the permit numbers because we had poor survival rate, but the Wildlife Board shot it down. I encourage the RAC to address this issue on our northeastern deer herd because they're in trouble. And last, about around October 11th, they got on our local radio, and Covey Jones was saying that it was the best hunt in the last 25 years for the deer hunt. That ain't right here in northeastern Utah. I can tell you it was the worst deer hunt I've seen in northeastern Utah general season in my life. And if you thought it was bad this year, please wait till next. Thank you.
Thanks, Blake. Just one clarification. Blake was referring to the late season muzzleloader hunt on the South Slope. That one has already been in effect. The proposal, Covey, I believe, it's in the next section, right? Where you were talking about the late season muzzleloader hunts, or was it in, or is that the topic now?
It's in both. It's in the plan as well.
Okay, just so the public knows, that hunt has already been happening on South Slope. I don't know if it was a pilot test project or what it is, but now the proposal now was to add it on all general season hunts but it has been in existence on the south slope.
The previous plan, it was written differently, and it was allowed on several units if they were at or if they were managed for 18 to 20 bucks per dose and above objective. And this plan is recommending it a little differently.
Oh, I see. It was targeted for the ones that were above objective. Okay, thank you. Kevin from Sportsman's Fish and Wildlife.
Kevin Norman representing Sportsman's for Fish and Wildlife. Thank you guys for letting me have a minute. Sportsman's for Fish and Wildlife has a fulfillment committee where Covey comes and presents to everybody from all over the state, and we form a stance on these issues. And SFW supports the new mule deer plan, with the exception that we would like to see the late muzzleloader hunt stay as is on the higher buck to doe ratios, and also that so that's it for that. I'd like to take a second speaking for myself, Kevin Norman, speaking to this late muzzleloader hunt. I'm from up in Cache County, and our deer's in awful shape. I have a good friend that's on our SFW committee up there. He is heavily involved with the biologists up there and loves to go count. He flies with them. He knows what he's doing. He's been out counting deer for the last 8 days. He's counted 227 deer, of which four were bucks, 1 4-point, a 3x4, a 2-point, and a spike, which equals a 1.7 buck to doe ratio. I know it's probably obviously going to come in higher than that, but this late muzzleloader hunt, the way it's written, would add 33 more buck tags to the cache. We're nervous that the bucks are, there's even enough to breed all the does. So by adding this could be detrimental, and it seems like we're going backwards. What my personal recommendation is, which passed in the northern, was having a safeguard in it that if the buck to doe ratio is under objective, that it defaults to 5 permits only. Right now it's written that it's 5 or 0.5%, whichever is greater. 0.5% is 33 up there, and it just cannot happen. Also, I would like to recommend we have this new HAMS hunt in place, handgun archery muzzleloader primitive weapon hunt. And I think it would be a great idea to have this late muzzleloader be the HAMS hunt as well. I have a long-range muzzleloader, just killed an elk at 671 yards. They're not muzzleloaders anymore. They're single-shot rifles. And I myself, no one's going to police themselves on holding back on what we're doing. This HAMS hunt will keep the hunt in the hunt, and I think that's what we should do. It'll be a lower success rate, provide opportunity, and I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin. Kobe, would you clarify that? Is that a permit number that would come in the spring that would be discussed, or is that a fixed number the way it was presented, the late season muzzleloader?
Yeah, that's a good clarification. So the way it's currently written in the plan is that it would be recommended at 0.5% or 5, whichever is greater, just like Kevin said. Other racks have felt uncomfortable with that and written it could be recommended up to 0.5% or the way that Kevin said it.
It's still a recommendation that could be addressed at the time of the permit numbers by the racks?
It could be, but the way it's written now, it would be it's more set in the plan. You'd want to change, if you want it to be a recommendation instead of a set number, you would want to change the verbiage in the plan.
Thank you. Miles will address the comments on this subject that have come in electronically.
Yes, so this, this is the second rack where we've had
the online video presentations, and then the ability to have folks submit electronic comments. Basically, the comments allowed the option for the commenters to either support, remain neutral, or disapprove or oppose the proposals as they were presented. And then it also gave an opportunity for the commenters to leave some feedback. The RAC members were all provided a copy of those individual responses and have had the opportunity to look at those comments. I'm going to summarize basically what the percentages were for this proposal. So for the statewide deer plan, overall in the state, 46.56% of the respondents supported the plan, 24.22% remained neutral, and 29.23% opposed. In the Northeast region, our comments only equaled about 6% of the total statewide comments, but specifically to the Northeast region, 42.86% of the respondents supported this proposal, 25% remained neutral, and 32.14% opposed.
Thank you. Kobe, could you give us a brief summary of what the other RACs have done with this?
It's been a long couple of weeks. I don't remember exactly what all the other RACs have done with this. It's passed with various modifications. Most of the recommendations have been focused around this late season muzzleloader hunt, wanting more ability to adapt that based on the year.
Thank you.
You could ask if there's any clarification.
Does anyone on the board or the public need any clarification of any issues before we act on this?
So yeah, Dan Abeda, I've got a question, again, just maybe some clarification. You probably already mentioned this, but since there does seem to be a lot of discussion about this late season muzzleloader hunt, so that would only, the proposal is that the unit would have to be at or above?
No, not anymore.
Objective?
Dan, that's how it was written before, and what we realized is that was a really bad way to write it. When we wrote it that way, we didn't realize the negative impacts it would have. But we had folks showing up at RAC saying, hey, I really like this late season muzzleloader. Don't add more general season permits, because if you do and you manage for the buck-doe ratio you're supposed to, they'll take that away from me. And we don't want to write an incentive to not manage to the objective. So we wrote it differently this time. And really, it's this is however, this is completely social. Like I said before, right, what the division's trying to do is provide a limited entry opportunity without converting more units to limited entry. And if the RAC and board feels like they want a little more control over these permit numbers, we completely understand that.
Okay, if there's no other discussion, I would entertain a motion from the RAC on this topic.
Brett, I'll make a motion. I'll make the motion to approve or support the statewide deer management plan as presented, with a change in the verbiage on the late season muzzleloader hunt, that language say up 2.5%. Is that what SFW was thinking?
Just the total five tags, wasn't it?
Well, if total five tags, if the population is not to a certain point, but if it's above that point, then it's 0.5% of those tags. To me, it seems like it would give the managers, the DWR, a little more management leeway, would it not? And I think as much, the more leeway we can put in management, the better off we are. And so we don't get locked into something we may not want. So that's that's a lot of.
So whether I understand that, up to 0.5% with a minimum of 5.
Correct.
Okay.
I think that would give the leeway.
Okay. We have a motion on the table.
I'll second it.
Seconded by Commissioner Horrocks. I'll call for a vote. All in favor?
Can we have some discussion on that, Mr. Chairman?
We have a motion and a second. Okay, go ahead, Dan.
So with that, I think the way I see, I feel that, and has been perceived, is that we try to set a cap for some of these units that are in a poor area. So now maybe it's my understanding and misunderstanding thereof, I guess, but have more of a 0.5% could lead up to 30, 40, 50 bucks in that late season. What the fear is being too many, and that 0.5% is set, right? So the way it's understood is that it's 0.5% or 5.
The motion was up to 0.5% to leave the discretion annually to the DWR to make a recommendation up to 5.5%.
Correct. So based on the total number of permits, we would go up to 0.5%, and that was the concern brought forward, is having too many permits based off of the total objective that's put out there. So I'm leaning towards more of a 5, 10, 15 tier type ratio based on herd health and buck to doe ratio objectives, and keeping that top end number from getting so high. And those are the concerns that I feel came from the public, and not having too many permits for that late season in that manner.
So at this point, we'd either need to modify the motion or else go ahead and vote on this motion.
We have a motion and a second.
And a second.
So I think we need to address the motion that's on the table, unless somebody withdraws their motion and changes it, or...
Can we still discuss a little? Well, I think by changing that verbiage, it would allow the DWR to do that. To decrease those if the population wasn't there or the buck to doe wasn't there, they could. I mean, we've got to go by their surveys. That's the only numbers we have. So, by changing that verbiage, that would allow them to decrease it. Right now, the way the verbiage is, I don't see how they could decrease that. They have to give that 0.5% on that late muzzleloader. But if they change the verbiage, they don't have to do that.
It's the motion allowed them to pick a number up to 0.5 with a minimum of 5.
I hope I'm correct.
So Dax, straighten us out here.
I'm Dax Magus. I'm the wildlife manager. Just thought maybe I'd just give a little bit of context to help you guys in making this decision. So the current mule deer management plan says units that are managed for 18 to 20 that are exceeding that objective, so a postseason buck to doe ratio of 18 to 20, if they're exceeding that, so they're 21 or higher, then we have these permits on those units. And in our region, we have several units that were in that category: the South Slope Yellowstone, the North Slope, the 9 Mile unit, and the Wasatch East. So in the Wasatch East, for example, that's our unit that we manage out of our region with the largest number of general season deer tags. Has about 4,000 general season deer tags. So one half of 1% on the Wasatch East unit would actually be about 20 permits. So, you know, just to kind of put it in context, and currently, because of the way it was written in the old plan, we went up to 1%. So actually in our region, we'll have to cut permits from what we're giving right now on units like the Current Creek, where, you know, right now I think it's closer to, it's 30 something. So we would actually cut permits. It would be more conservative if we went with this wording in the new plan. The wording in the new plan would take away that incentive to manage above your buck-to-doe ratio objective. And also add in, you know, those units that are managed in that 15 to 17 range. And then also just to clarify, you know, we really manage our buck-to-doe ratio through general season permits. You know, that's the bulk. The 99.5% of the permits are going to be general. And that's the tool we use to manage our buck-to-doe ratios. And, you know, statistically, an extra 5-10 permits on these units where we give literally thousands of permits, that's not managing our buck-to-doe ratio. We manage our buck-to-doe ratios with general season permits. And so when those general season permits, if our buck-to-doe ratio fell, we would lower general season deer permits, which would in turn also lower, you know, these permits if they were issued as well. So just to kind of provide some context of what we're doing now versus what it would look like in the future if they made the change as recommended.
Dax, to take that another step further, like Kobe, I think, mentioned the largest unit in the state is the Manti.
Yeah.
So how many general season tags is there on the Manti? Trying to put this into context.
8,000.
8,000.
8,800 sometimes. 8,600 right now. So over 8,000. So you'd have like 40 some of these. Yeah.
So that would be an additional 40 tags?
Yeah.
Roughly? Okay.
Hey, Dax. So appreciate the clarification. So I missed that part, I guess. So if that buck to doe ratio is not right, these tags aren't going to be offered anyway. So
that's the way it is currently. The new proposal would be that these permits would be offered on all of our units, including the 15 to 17 and the 18 to 20, and not just when they're exceeding, but just they'd be offered every year.
They go off with the deer the buck to doe ratio count in November. So if we have a bad winter,
that's what we set general season permits on, is based on those buck to doe ratios, and then these permits would be a function of what we do for general season.
So in rough times, you cut the general season way back, it's going to automatically
cut the muzzleloader back.
You know, down to the point where you get to like five permits, and five permits is not going to be statistically significant. It might be to the, you know, the three or four deer that might get killed on those five permits, but as far as managing a whole population in a buck to doe ratio, it's not going to, killing an additional four deer or something, it's not going to, if that tips your herd over, you've got bigger problems.
Yeah. Now, one, so procedurally, you got a motion on the table. We still have a second.
Yeah.
So we have a motion and a second to up to 0.5% of the general season tags, with a minimum of five. That's the recommendation. Okay. I will call for a vote on that issue. All in favor? We have three. All opposed? We have three in favor and four opposed, so that motion failed. I will now open for another motion.
Can I get a clarification question, Mr. Chair?
Okay.
So, Kobe, as this is presented with these percentages here, is this in a stance by the division to make it easier to establish that number so it's not, well, we took into consideration habitat, we took into consideration buck-to-doe ratio, and although we're allowed to give this many, you know, it gives the division an easier tool to say this many or this many. Is that kind of make it easier with the way the plan's written?
So it depends on how you want to look at it, Daniel. I think Dax hit the nail on the head when he said biologically these are so few permits on a general season unit that it doesn't matter. Socially, what the committee's goal was to lock them in so that you didn't have one unit offering 400 and one unit offering two. You just wanted to have some consistency across the state and tie it back to general season units. The consistency obviously is easier because the recommendation's done, right? It's done, it's set, you bring it forward. But I understand, I see both sides of this. I see some hesitancy among sportsmen, and I see the side where they say, hey, we'd like to recommend up to that. Biologically, Dax said it doesn't matter. You know, if you recommend 8,600 permits and you're talking about 40, it really doesn't matter. Socially, we had a really bad deer hunt on some units around the state. Right? Not every unit in the state did is doing poorly. Some units have maintained. No units are probably where they were at in 2016. No units are where they were at in 2016. Some units are affected more than others. And so this hunt has triggered some angst in sportsmen. That's the reality. There's some sportsmen who said, hey, we like the idea, great hunt, bad timing, basically, is what it's come down to. And really, it's kind of fun to watch the rack struggle through some of this, to be honest with you. But you could recommend it one way, and the division would just set those permits and bring them forward. Recommend it the other way, and we would probably set them at 0.5% and then argue about them here, like we do now.
You have a motion, Daniel?
Do you all make a motion? I make a motion that we accept the statewide deer management plan as presented with the following changes to set those late season deer hunts to a minimum of 5 and not to exceed 0.25%, and to provide the opportunity to have that as a hams hunt and not designated specifically for muzzle loading only.
Okay, does everyone understand that motion? Make it, that's minimum of 5, up to 0.25%, half of what was on the plan, and change it to a primitive weapon hams hunt, which would basically take out the modern muzzleloaders, or at least the scopes, right?
Add it to a method of take, not remove the muzzleloading completely.
Okay.
But add it as a hunting option.
Okay. Plus the hams. Thank you for clarifying that. Okay, we have a motion on the table. We have a second?
Yeah, I'll second that.
Seconded by Dan. All in favor? We have 4. Opposed? 3. The motion passes. Thank you.
Good job.
Okay, we will... I want to take just a moment to recognize Randy Durth, member of the Wildlife Board, that's with us tonight. Thanks for coming, Randy. And welcome Commissioner Horrocks to our meeting. With that, we'll roll into number 6, which is the bucks, bulls, and once in a lifetime season dates. When we get to comments on this, questions, this is where we're going to put the baiting issue for those of you that have comments on that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Kobe Jones again, here to present the 2020 big game season dates, boundary descriptions, and rule amendments. Starting with the general season deer hunt dates, not a lot of changes here. The only one that you'll note from the plan is that the late season limited entry muzzleloader hunt is recommended on all general season units now. There's a rollback of 2 days this year, and that's simply because of leap year. For the general season elk dates, again, those are the same as previously recommended. No changes here. Getting into the changes, so now what you'll see at the top, you'll see the region, followed by the species. and then the recommended change. And so starting with Southern Region recommendations and buck deer, recommending new, two new extended archery units, one on the Pine Valley, New Harmony, and one on the Southwest Desert Cedar Valley. These are both in areas where the division has a lot of depredation and conflict currently. And those of you who understand, private landowners that have land and cultivation have a right under state code to alleviation of the damage they receive from big game. And frankly, they should. That's the way that it should be. But the division likes to offer this opportunity to the public whenever we can, and not remove these deer ourselves. And so that's the thought behind these two extended archery units, is to offer that opportunity to the public and allow harvest instead of having division employees remove those animals. And both of these areas have high depredation and high conflict. Continued in buck deer, recommending a new handgun, archery, muzzleloader, shotgun hunt on the Kaparowitz. So you'll see us recommend three of these throughout here. You'll notice the season dates, they are late. This is a rut hunt. These permits are in areas where we have either very low deer densities, areas where we have populations that are unavailable other times of year, or areas where we have weapons conflicts. The Kaparowitz, for example, very low deer densities, not a lot of hunters there, not a lot of deer there during the regular seasons. This is a very remote area. You're going to have to strap on a backpack and figure it out. But it's a great opportunity. Just, and we'll state this now, that these hunts, we're going to start out very, very slow on these. These will not offer a lot of permits. And I'm sure they'll be highly coveted. A reminder, we're not discussing permit numbers tonight, but I can commit to that. Starting in the southern region with desert bighorn sheep, recommending a boundary change on the Pine Valley unit. And if the RAC, and everyone remembers, last year we brought forward a new statewide bighorn management plan. And one of the strategies in the plan was to, at times, divide units up so that we could direct hunters to areas where sheep currently weren't being pursued and provide that additional opportunity. So that's what this does on the Pine Valley. It divides it up from one big unit to the Beaver Dam unit and the Virgin River unit. We can direct hunters to pockets of sheep that currently aren't being hunted. Also recommending a new pronghorn hunt, new pronghorn hunts on the Panguitch Lake Zion North and on the Pine Valley. Southern region continued, recommending a new Rocky Mountain bighorn sheep hunt on the Fillmore Oak Creek unit. So this is one of the most exciting recommendations. We just flew this unit, we counted it, and we have an estimated population of about 200 bighorns on the unit now. What a success. You know, what a great partnership with our sportsmen's groups and everybody else that we did to get these sheep there. And we have a thriving population. On this flight, we counted about 70 rams. And so in order to manage those ram numbers, we need to divide this hunt. When we get ram to ewe ratios that are too high, we end up with wandering rams and increase our potential for disease to this population. I'll answer this time, but those are Californias. I mean, they're Rockies, but they're Californias. The southeastern region recommendations continued, or southeastern region recommendations for buck deer. Recommending a new extended archery unit in the 9 Mile Green River Valley. This is in and around an area where we have high conflict. And recommending a new handgun archery muzzleloader shotgun hunt. And this is in the Book Cliffs, Floyd Canyon. This is everything west of Thompson. This is in an area where we have deer that spend a lot of the time in remote areas, inaccessible areas up in the roadless and the cliffs. And this time of year provides an opportunity to be able to hunt those animals that are other times inaccessible. For desert bighorn sheep in the southeast region, recommending a few boundary changes on the San Juan to the San Juan Lockhart and the San Juan South, and that's to accommodate two new units, the San Juan North that we're bringing back and the San Juan San Juan River. Again, in an effort to direct hunters to pockets of sheep that are there that currently aren't being pursued. The northern region, recommending boundary changes to the cache unit to remove the Clarkston Mountains. Remember last year, we brought a recommendation to remove the Wellsville Mountains. And when we did that, the sportsman said, well, why did we leave the Clarkston Mountains in? And we said, well, it was an oversight. We probably shouldn't have. It's low elk densities, and it's an area of high conflict. So we're recommending to remove that. Also recommending to remove a small portion of the cache south limited entry, an area in and around the town of Hiram. And then a recommendation to add both of those areas to the Annie Bowl, add the Clarkston Mountains and a small portion around the cache south. Northern Region continued, recommending to change the extended archery boundary, add the contiguous land on the northeast portion of the Wasatch Front, and I believe this is Davis County, and recommending a new extended archery unit for elk, West Cache. This is some of the land that we just changed out of limited entry to Annie Bowl. For buck deer in the northern region, recommending boundary changes to the extended archery units to add the land to the West Cache, to add the contiguous public land on the northeast portion of the Wasatch Front, like we did with elk, and to discontinue the Cache Lake Town extended archery unit. This is an area where we had a lot of urban conflict, and with the current population, we don't have that conflict there now. And the people in the area have just said, we're okay with the number of deer here right now. Also recommending a new handgun archery muzzle or shotgun hunt on the Morgan South Ridge unit. Mountain goat. I wish this story were as good as the sheep, but it's not. Recommending to discontinue the Ogden Willard Peak nanny hunt. We currently have watched that population dip, and we no longer need to harvest nannies in that area to manage the population objective. And we're recommending to bring back, it's our turn, for the Rocky Mountain Bighorn Sheep Tag on the Pilot Mountains. This unit we have in a collaborative agreement with Nevada, so we hunt it 1 year, they hunt it 1 year. We're hoping to change that and be able to offer a sheep tag there in conjunction with Nevada every year for the next several years. The sheep that was harvested on that unit this year was 11 years old. And there are several other sheep with him that were old as well. So we'd like to take advantage of that resource before those animals die of old age. Also, the dates are set by that collaborative agreement, and we hope to adjust those to align with Utah hunt dates and allow for a little bit later hunt there. In the northeastern region, starting with bison, as we watch the population, the bison population on the book cliffs come into the objective or approach the objective, we've had to add a lot of new hunts and adjust to be able to manage that population more appropriately. Some of this is to have enough hunts on the books to where we don't have to apply too much pressure on any one hunt. Bison are very, very sensitive to pressure. They'll move, they'll become inaccessible, they'll go places we don't want them, do things we don't want them to do. And so we're recommending some boundary changes. First, to remove the roadless portion, and that allows us to have roadless specific hunts. I don't think anybody's going to go into the roadless to target a bison unless they have a permit for it. Just why would you do that unless that's what you drew? Also, we're recommending some date changes on the Bookcliffs hunts, and those dates removed to prevent weapon type conflict and overlap, and recommending some new hunts. Bookcliffs archery only hunter's choice hunt there in August, and a new cow hunt in the roadless. For bighorn sheep, are recommending to split the North Slope unit into North Slope Three Corners Bear Top and North Slope West Agate, and again in an effort to direct hunters to areas of sheep that aren't currently being hunted. For Central Region, buck deer, recommending a boundary change on the extended archery unit in Sand Pete. This boundary change is to make a more enforceable boundary. We ran into some law enforcement issues on this boundary last year, and we realized we had a problem, fix it. Rocky Mountain Bighorn Sheep in the Central Region, recommending to split out the Wasatch West and the Nebo. We have enough sheep there to split those back out. So some key dates, just as a reminder. The application period opens January 30th and closes March 5th, with the extension through the 19th of March if your goal is just to buy a point. As always, Lindy promises the results will be published by May 29th, and she usually gets them out earlier. And then, just as a reminder, there is a season for purchasing and selling antlers, heads, or horns of legally taken big game. That's from February 1st to July 31st. Also, we do offer hunt extensions for hunters with qualifying disabilities. Below are those. On to the rule amendments. With the new CWD plan, there's some rule amendments that need to go along with that. One is new, and the other one just simplifies regulations, and they already exist. So the new one, the division may require mandatory CWD testing on certain units and or specific hunts. In order to get a good sense of prevalence, we need a minimum number of samples. And this is at times hard for us to obtain. And so if we are sampling an area where we can't or haven't been able to reach that minimum number, we may require mandatory harvest reporting, or mandatory sampling, I'm sorry. Also, before, as I mentioned, it used to be written in rule that there was no importing whole carcasses from positive counties or wildlife management units, and now it's just positive states. If you hunt Colorado, don't bring in your whole deer. If you hunt Wyoming, don't bring in your whole deer. One more change, and this is really just some housekeeping. At the end of October, beginning of November, parks met, and they've had kind of a change in philosophy. And the way parks, state parks rule used to read is that all state parks were closed to hunting unless otherwise authorized by rule. And in an effort to be more accepting of all activities, they said, you know, we should really write this differently. We should really have all parks, all state parks open to hunting. And then in areas where we know we're going to have a conflict, we'll prohibit hunting in those areas. And so this rule change is just to align our rule with what state parks rule currently is. And so it's just hunting in state parks is allowed unless otherwise specified, and that's their rule cited there at the bottom. And that's all. Thank you.
Thanks, Kobe. I'll entertain questions from the RAC.
What happened to the Willard Peak goat herd?
Probably a combination of, you know, we've had high harvest over the last several years. In addition to that, it could be some climatic events that have led to poor kid recruitment. The population just isn't, it's not doing as well as it once was.
Let's go back to the Buffalo Little Creek slide, would you?
Sure. And before this, I should mention, if there's anything outside of the region or from a statewide perspective, I would love to answer that. But the biologists wait all year for this RAC meeting and are super excited and would love to answer any regional specific questions.
What was your comments on the bison there? You said about the roadless area with the boundary changes.
I can explain that, or Dax can, or Clint's here too. He gets really excited. But what we're trying to do is be able to direct pressure where we need it. So in order to have roadless specific hunts, we pulled the roadless area out of some hunts.
But you're turning around and giving a cow hunt in there.
Yeah. Well,
the issue is they're not getting hunters to go in the roadless, and they're... Dax, do you want to talk about what you... Oh, Clint, sorry about that.
Oh, yeah. Clint got a haircut for this.
Clint will tell you what's going on out there. We talked about this the other night at the Book Cliff thing.
Clint Sampson, a wildlife biologist. So basically we're forcing more harvest to take place in the roadless. When we counted last year, I mean, we were right up with sightability. We were right up close to our objective of 450 wintering adults. And the majority of that population objective is in the roadless area itself. So it's us trying to force people's hands to go in there and hunt. And there is a demand. It's the same thing we do for elk. We split the elk we split the limited entry elk permits. We have the roadless or the Little Creek hunt, and then we have the Bitter Creek South hunt as well. So basically doing the same thing there.
All right, thank you. Any other questions? Jamie?
On your bighorn sheep hunt, I'm not finding the boundaries for that Wasatch West. Is that going to be separate from, because I know it used to be just the Wasatch, right? Did that include the east side of Indian Canyon?
Derek Ewell with the biologist for that area. So the new boundary is, so next year there will not be a hunt on the Vindiquin unit.
Okay.
The sheep population is down so low and there's very few rams left, so we decided to just discontinue that hunt. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Any other questions from the rack? Okay, I will entertain questions from the public. This is not I have the comment cards. If there is any questions to clarify any issues, now's your time. Please step up. Okay, we have no questions. I will address comments from the rack. Is there any? I have one, Kobe. This time of year, there seems to be a pretty big division of people that love the extended archery buck hunting till November 30th, and those that really don't like it at all. And I know Ken brought that up. And has that been a topic around the state? Ken recommended to stop the buck hunting a little earlier than the doe hunting, right? That was what you said.
It really hasn't been a topic around the state. And I know that there's some division in sentiments among this. Overall, I think the plan is eventually to probably have these extended archery units become standalone. Right now, with what we're dealing with, mule deer, we're dealing with about 90,000 permits and about 160,000 applicants, right? Everybody wants to hunt deer every year. And they also want us to offer less permits. As long as they get one, everything's good. And so the goal is have enough of these extended archery units around to say, hey, here's an opportunity to hunt deer. It'll take your points just like everything else, but you could go hunt extended. And that's one of the reasons why the division's pushed to keep these and expand these. We're not there yet, and we're not making that recommendation tonight, but you may see a recommendation like that from us in the future.
Okay, thank you. And then before we take comments from the public, I would like to address the baiting issue.
Sure.
We've got a lot of emails, and I witnessed kind of the bad side of baiting recently of a bait on a property 2 feet from a fence, baiting over a fence, and then they actually shot the deer with a bow and thought it wouldn't jump back in the fence, I guess, and caused the law enforcement and all the other issues that come with that. And then we've seen, I don't know if those in the audience are aware of it, but baiting is a big part of hunting in the southern part of the state, primarily, maybe statewide, as all these comments come out. So has that been addressed quite a bit at the RAC meetings or just in the southern?
No, it's come up at every RAC meeting, and they've asked the division what their plan is, and I've let them know what happened, where we are, and where we intend to go. And if you'd like me to do that, Mr. Chair, I can.
Yes, please.
Okay, so we asked the public in the mule deer survey how they felt about baiting. And 44% were opposed to baiting, a 30, I don't remember, 30, I don't remember if it was 33%, I think, were in favor of continuing to allow baiting. So overall, more hunters were opposed to baiting than in favor of baiting. We took that back to the Mule Deer Committee, and we worked through some of it with the Mule Deer Committee, and it came to a vote on the Mule Deer Committee. And overwhelmingly, the Mule Deer Committee voted to ask the division to write a rule to ban baiting in the state of Utah. So I did. We went back, we worked with our attorneys, we started to write a rule. We wrote a rule that would ban baiting in the state of Utah. Baiting is illegal in all the western states except for Utah. Baiting of big game is illegal in all the western states except for Utah and Oregon. Those are the only two states that allow baiting. And in writing a rule, looking at other states' rules, we realized a few things. Essentially, to write an effective, enforceable rule that would ban baiting, you have to ban placing an attractant, right? Because if you don't write it that way, well then, not my pile of apples, man. I didn't know it was there. And you can put season dates on bait, but then whose job is it to clean it up? And you don't address any of the biological concerns. If you don't address making it illegal to place an attractant, you don't address the disease concerns and the other concerns. So that's the way we wrote it. And we realized when we finished that we'd written a rule that prohibited feeding. And we also realized that we hadn't done the work to make a recommendation to prohibit feeding. We hadn't discussed that with all the interested parties. So what we realized is there's more work to be done. But know that the division intends to take this on. The reason why is because baiting and long-term feeding of wildlife is detrimental to wildlife. It's bad for deer. There's a ton of research on this that shows that if you bait, you congregate. If you congregate, you increase disease. There's also a lot of research that shows that if you feed, you destroy habitat. Long-term feeding destroys habitat. And so the division wants to address that. We hadn't done the work yet. And we intend to address that. We hope to address that in the coming year.
Thank you. Will you address likely the technology issue of the streaming cameras on the bait stations and stuff like that at that time, or is that a separate issue?
That's a separate issue. In doing some of this research, one of the other questions we asked was about technology. Did the public want to be limited on technology? And overall, the response was no. They didn't want to be limited on trail cameras or technology. We brought that to the Mule Deer Committee and said, how does the Mule Deer Committee feel about that? And they said, you know, if we could put trail cameras back in the bag completely and get rid of them, that would be more equitable. They felt like that would be great, but they realized they couldn't. So the Mule Deer Committee settled on a recommendation to the division to ban live feed cameras. Took that back to our attorneys, looked through the law, and realized that everything we do, all the authority we have is to regulate take. We don't have any legal authority over trail cameras. And so that is something that the legislature would have to give us. And we may work through that issue this year.
Okay, thank you. We'll move into the comments from the public. Kent, would you like to speak first?
Yes. My name is Kent Olson.
Just tip it down. I don't think we can hear you very well.
You hear me now?
Yeah.
Anyway, my name is Ken Olson. I'm assigned off the Farm Bureau Board in Duchesne County to come to this meeting monthly, but that's not why I'm here tonight. I'm here as a landowner and a sportsman. I like to hunt, too. And I see that there's been some changes on the issue. I brought this up three times. This is my third time I brought it to the meeting. The first two times, it's the wrong meeting. And I was told that November is the meeting to bring this up at. But I have 112 acres. Eighth of a mile west of the Sundance grounds in Neola, Utah. And I would like to see them stop hunting buck deer after the 1st of November with the extended orchery. And the reason is, I have about 7 or 8 head of does in my field all the time. And I've got 2 fields. One's that's half a mile south of Neola, and I have does in that field too. But I don't have buck deer year-round. They show up at the rut. And I see you've shortened it up. It used to be into December, right? The extended archery used to go into December. and I see it's the 30th of November, but I would like to, I think you've done it backwards. You should shut it off from the 1st of November to the 30th and then let them go back hunting buck deer in December. But I had three dead does 2 years ago in my field from archery hunters, and nobody asked me for permission to hunt my property, and if they would have, I would give it to them. But I have a 112 acres that's split into 56 and 56. It's a half mile long right there. And my cows are in the north end, calving out, and when the snow melts, I put my cows in the bottom end. And when I put them in the bottom end, down the bottom 56, I have to ride it with a four-wheeler to check for newborn calves. That's when I found these dead deer, you know. But I'd like to see you stop the... U Tribe doesn't even hunt after the 1st of November. Their buck season ends on the 1st of November, if I'm right, Jamie. Yeah. And I feel like that these deer, these buck deer, are the reservation is 3 miles north of me. Other than the Sundance grounds is an eighth of a mile, and I think these buck deer are coming off the reservation, you know. So a lot of these guys that are hunting with an archery are not hunting until the 1st of November when they start to rut and they go out and go after them. But anyway, that's my statement.
Thank you. To clarify it, the deer extended archery goes to November 30th, buck and doe, and the elk goes to December 15th, bull and cow. So if anybody has any elk comments. Bruce Dark, would you like to speak next, please?
My name is Bruce Dart. I'm a landowner on the North Mountain Bench.
Talk into the mic just a little bit more.
Thank All right. You. Bruce Dart, North Mountain Bench, a landowner, also a hunter and a sportsman, and I've been watching this extended archery hunt. Just started last year, and this year it's very obvious that there's a disadvantage to the buck deer. They're out of their survival mind. They're into the rut. They're getting taken advantage of. And the way these hunters are, they set their cameras up before the season. They know where the deer are running in and out. When they do that, they put their bait out there. I'm familiar with the baiting situation right across the fence. I can literally stand there and I could fall over. If I fell over the fence, I'd fall right in it. I have to admit, the baiting does work. They put their tent up there, and the deer are sleeping right next to the tent. It's very effective what the bait does. I've kind of changed the name of the extended archery hunt. I call it a bait, sit and wait. And I don't see the sportsmanship of putting some bait out here, putting a tent 30 yards away, 20 yards away, and then a buck that is not in his survival mind, he walks up there and he gets shot at. Killed in an instance just recently. It was wounded and come on to my place, and the hunter did ask for permission to get it, and he said it was dead, but when we walked up to where he said it was dead, it jumped up and hobbled off, and I let him look on the place. They looked, searched for it, didn't find it. That night I went back on the county road and on my property to see if I could find any blood where it wandered up to a cornfield. They said it went into my cornfield. And I didn't see any blood trails that night. I didn't see any the next morning where it come up during the night. And the case has kind of been, I don't know, it's gotten out of hand. I've been bashed on Facebook about me letting the animal rot in the cornfield. It wasn't my doings. I didn't shoot the deer. I'm a taxpayer on the property, If I don't want somebody running through my cornfield, destroying the corn, I'm not going to let them. If it's over in the Badlands like this was, it's fine. I did let them. It's just been a bad deal. I don't approve of the hunt. I think the big game hunts any hunts, regardless of archery or rifle. They ought to be over by October 31st, and just let the deer be natural. We're talking about conception rates, birthing rates, and here we are messing with Mother Nature on how they're bred. So I recommend that the hunts end on October 31st and that you eliminate the baiting. I just don't think it's a sportsmanlike hunt. And I appreciate your time. I've been quiet over the years. I haven't really said much to anybody. But this year, it just got to me.
Thank you. Thank you, Bruce.
Thank you.
Blake?
Blake Bess, representing the sportsman, dedicated hunter. And I agree with Mr. Dart, Mr. Olson. I'll be the first to admit I'm first offender on this extended archery. We're hunting these bucks August, September, October, November. Don't get a break. Our deer are in bad shape around here, as we all know. They're hunting them to death. And with our modern-day archery equipment on our property up around Altamont, we notice a lot of bucks. We've seen several over the last few years with arrows hanging out of them. It's just these archery hunters ain't being ethical. And as Mr. Dart said, these bucks, they got one thing on their mind, and that's women. They ain't worried about these archers. I think I'd recommend the rack to try to do something about the season dates on the extended archery buck deer. I'd like to see that get shut down quite a bit early, or to give our mature bucks a rest in sense to maybe breed some does without being pressured. Thank you.
Thanks, Blake. Ken?
Ken Powell, I'm representing myself as a sportsman and a dedicated hunter. You know, with this extended archery permits, I hear a lot of people, and they do it. They put in for these hunts, and they don't draw, but they can buy a deer tag over the counter in another county, in another hunting area, and then they come up here and hunt into the extended archery. They come up here and hunt or any other place in the state. I think they need to do away with that. Just like you're talking about, Covey, about putting into a special hunt. That, to me, is wrong. Just because you're a dedicated hunter, I've heard other people say, well, I'm not going to burn a tag on a doe as a dedicated hunter. Well, you got 3 years, two bucks. You can kill two deer in 3 years. If your first year you don't kill nothing, and you're out there hunting, take a doe. Do your management part of it. Take a doe in the dedicated hunt in the extended archery areas. We need to take out some of these does for the management part. Everybody knows that. Sometimes people get upset about it, but we need to do this. So my recommendation is no bucks in November. Doe only if you want to do it, just to help alleviate, because you know the farmers are having problems with it. They get their tags, they get their depredation tags. So the fishing game don't come in and wipe them out, because they'll do it at nighttime, and everybody knows they'll do it if they have to. So that's my recommendation. Thank you.
Thanks, Ken. Al?
I'm Al Kettle and represent myself and landowners. On the extended archery hunt, one of the problems that we've encountered at our place on our farm is we don't hunt the deer ourselves at all on our place. We go to the mountains, we hunt up there. Quite often we'll have people sneaking in the fence. We have on our fence line, we have a big group of Russian olives, about 90 acres. We'll have people sneak in through the Russian olives trying to get these bucks during the extended archery hunt. If that was at a doe only on the extended archery, I feel like we'd have a whole lot less trespassing issues with people trying to come on and find these bigger bucks that, you know, we don't hunt them, we like to see them. So that's the fun is seeing them out in the field. During the wintertime, we'll have 50, 60 headed deer on our place. And, you know, we don't get depredation tags. We don't get any of that because we feel like that's a safe place for them and it's not causing us problems. So anyway, that's what I had for tonight.
Thanks, Al. Miles, would you address the comments statewide that came in online on this?
Okay, yeah, statewide for the bucks, bulls, and once-in-a-lifetime recommendations, 53.86 percent respondents supported the proposal, 24.63% were neutral, and 21.5% opposed. In the Northeast region, we had 39.29% support, 32.14% were neutral, and 28.57% opposed. So they were basically mirrored the statewide, just at a different level.
Thank you. Is there any more discussion from the RAC? Does anybody need anything clarified or any questions for the people that commented to understand what they were recommending? Go ahead, Daniel.
Colby, could you cover again the purpose of the extended archery hunt?
There are several purposes, but I just want to remind the RAC that under the new process, after public comment, then the division, the district biologist, and everyone should have a chance to rebuttal or answer any questions.
Okay.
But, so the purpose of the extended archery hunt, there are several purposes, and it's different in different places, you know. Remember, when we're making these recommendations, that along the Wasatch Front, we have areas where you cannot harvest a buck or a bull with anything but a bow. And so in those areas, we have to have extended archery, and it's primarily on public land. There are other areas where we have extended archery in areas to do just that, provide the opportunity to sportsmen to harvest these animals, because if not, under state code, we have to alleviate the damage that a landowner is experiencing, and we get asked to do this a lot. And we'll come in and we'll remove those animals under state code, or we can offer this opportunity to the public.
Randall, would you be willing to come up and talk about the local? I know you deal with the issue daily this time of year, don't you? So you can give a little historical perspective, and then maybe, Kobe, we want to give you your rebuttal if you disagree with any of this.
Sure. Randall Thacker, wildlife biologist, Northeast region. Originally when the extended archery was created in our region out here in the Northeast region, it was one of the first ones we did in the state. The intent was to try to help reduce some of the agricultural deer. It was really intended to try to be more to ease some of the depredation problems we had and try to remove both sexes out there. We figured at the time, because the population, there's so many more of them, or does, that it would be higher in the doe harvest out there. I just looked real quick to get numbers. It's essentially turned into now a recreational hunt, and there's folks who love it. Last year we had 545 hunters who hunted the extended archery here in Duchesne, Uinta County. So that's our hunt here in the region. And those folks, some of them are very, very passionate about it. They love it. We harvested 26 does, and 122 total bucks were harvested in the extended archery last year. They kind of broke it out by counties, and so it's 25% to 30% success. So it's actually a higher success rate on the extended archery than what we got on our general season hunts for archery, just straight archery hunts during that time, a little bit higher even. So it's a good hunt. Folks do love it and enjoy it. There's some of them who really like it. We have a lot of landowners who don't like it. We get a lot of feedback from them, folks who don't appreciate the trespass. A lot of them are just ethically bothered, I think, by the concept that you're hunting an animal in the rut. And on to counter that, though, we hunt elk in the rut, too, in the state of Utah. You know, we hunt a lot of things during different seasons of the year. So
There's some arguments to be made either way, I think, on this one. It's a more of a social issue than it is biological. We do need to have some way to remove some of these animals. I'll tell you, it's not removing enough does for us. Our agricultural deer populations are definitely increasing and have just continued to grow. We have some GPS collars out there. We know most of those resident deer never leave. Those are resident agricultural area deer. They may stay on your place today and maybe on your neighbors or within 2 or 3 miles of you and then over the course of the year, but they rarely leave and rarely go back to the mountain except for those that do come down late season here. When we do hit November-ish like they're talking about, we do start to see some migratory animals show up. Most of those show up around the periphery, around the tribal boundary and that kind of stuff, around the edge of the extended archery boundary. Down lower in some of the lower elevations, they're very much resident deer, and they aren't leaving at all. We've had a real increase in the last 5-6 years at least, seeing real increases. The deer herd's gone up, as you saw that chart earlier that Covey showed the population. We've also seen real increases in the numbers of roadkill in the basin here, too. And that just correlates directly with the increase in deer in agricultural and residential areas that we've seen. And so we are going to have to find some ways to increase some harvest probably in some of these agricultural and rural settings in town to try to address some of that kind of stuff too if we don't have the extended archery. But it's accomplishing part of the job, but not near enough. It's not. We're probably going to have to find some new ways to address some of these things in the future.
Thank you. Any other biologists want to speak? How's extended? Derek's ducking. He says he's good. You spoke for him.
I have one more question.
Okay. Oh, sorry, Jamie. Go ahead.
So you said 26 does were harvested for the extended archery. That's hunters, right? How many permits are given to landowners to harvest does?
Don't have those numbers off the top of my head. We do have our landowner depredation permit program. They can get up to, if they have enough deer, if they have deer on their property and it's an agricultural operation, they can get up to 5 free permits each for antlerless deer for does. I could look it up for you here in a few minutes and get you the exact numbers of how many we do. I have it on my computer. I don't have it on my head on how many. There's hundreds of those permits given out each year.
Are they pretty successful?
As far as number percentage of permits given out, no. Most of them don't fill their tags, in all honesty. A lot of them seem to just want to have the tags. But we have a few folks that do want to help remove the animals on their property, and they'll be 100% success for those folks. But in general, overall, most of them don't fill the tags that they're given. If so, they'll fill one, and that's about it. And they'll stop on that. My phone?
Thank you.
We can get you those numbers, though, Jamie. I can get you specific numbers if you're interested at all.
No, I was
significantly,
just wondering, in addition to the 26 does, how many were taken?
It's a lot Thank bigger you. Number than the extended
Much archery. Higher than the 26 that are taken through extended right. archery.
Brett, I've been calling.
Yeah, I've got a question for you, Randall. These bucks that are being harvested during the extended archery hunt, are they... are these bucks affecting the buck-to-doe ratios, that you guys are doing for the subunits?
Not significantly. We also, too, because they are resident deer, basically, that are down there, we intentionally try not to go down there and take too big of a sample when we do our classification samples. We try to be more representative of the public land animals up on the forest. And that's usually where we do classify for most of those. We try it because those are higher. There's so much protection provided them by private landowners, some who love them and some who hate them. But it's a totally different situation now. Their production is different, too. We don't want to come up use those fawn-to-doe ratios out of those agricultural areas where they're getting a much higher quality of feed down there than they will up high. And so we try to avoid that for our classification and when we do those samples. And so it doesn't really affect us one way or the other that way. It wouldn't be that significant.
Just a comment on the extended archery. I would hate to see that extended archery removed as a management tool. We're talking about specific areas in agriculture, urban areas. We're not talking about units as a general. So those bucks that are being hunted in the rut or in specific areas, they're not being hunted in other areas of the unit in the rut. And so, and like Randall mentioned, it's not only the agriculture stuff. These extended archery hunts are in urban areas where vehicle wildlife collisions are higher. Maybe it could be tweaked a little. Maybe we could encourage a higher doe harvest or something. But in general, I'd hate to see that extended archery removed as a management tool. As a manager of quite a lot of private land, I allow hunters in that extended archery. I budget a certain amount of my forage going to wildlife every year. I kind of know what I expect them to take, and so I kind of know what my wildlife big game numbers should be. I can use that extended archery as a land manager to say, okay, if I allow this many harvest or this much pressure, I'm going to keep my forage that those wildlife are taking about where I want it. And so, like the DWR tries to manage statewide for their habitat, that extended archery allows me to manage my wildlife population on private land to about where I'm willing to budget it, which is pretty high budget. You know, we estimate 2-3% of our forage is going to go to big game. And so we'll manage according to that, and we're fine with that. So.
Thank you.
I'd like to make a comment. So years back, we got in a big stigma about growing our population and pretty much wiped out any opportunity for a doe hunt if it wasn't depredation related. I would echo Richie on not wanting to get rid of that extended archery, but do like to see in the plan that we have the opportunity to bring those doe hunts back and create opportunity through the HAMS process or what have you to target populations if we're not meeting objectives. So I'd hate to see that go away as well.
And both of you are talking buck and doe. Okay. Just to clarify it, because most of the comments were just about the bucks. All the comments were just about the bucks, the dates.
Let me answer the question that Jamie asked. Amy was good enough to look the date up for me back there. On the private lands depredation type of permits, there was almost 800 permits given out between the free, 720 of the free ones, 60 of the fee ones, the vouchers that they would pay for. Between those tags, we harvested last year 209, or actually just over that, so about 315 does basically, right? Taken on those.
Thank you.
That's significantly more than the 28 we're talking on the.
Yes. Okay. Remember, we're talking about the topic, the big topic, and you're welcome to break out the extended archery or the baiting issue if you want, or any other issue enclosed in there. And I would entertain. Ready for a motion, right? I would entertain a motion at this time.
Mr. Chairman, I'll make a motion. I motion that we accept the Bucks, Bulls, Once in a Lifetime proposal as presented from the division.
I'll second that.
We have a motion and a second to accept the presentation as presented with no changes. All in favor? That's 6. All opposed? 1 opposed. Motion passes.
Thank you.
We're going to take about a 10-minute break right now, and then we'll be back and finish the agenda. At CWMU Management Plans.
I think that would appeal more to the public.
You should have done what? This?
Yes.
I was afraid Daniel
Buck. He's coming.
Not he's coming, yeah.
Okay, we will continue with our agenda. Chad Wilson is going to present the CWMU management plans and permit numbers 2020.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Like you said, I'm Chad Wilson. I'm the Private Lands Public Wildlife Coordinator out of Salt Lake. I will be talking about the 2020 CWMU Cooperative Wildlife Management Unit and Landowner Association Buck and Bull recommendations. To give you a quick overview of the difference between those two programs, CWMUs are generally large contiguous lands, private lands, 5,000 acres or more, that form their own unit within a hunt unit or multiple hunt units. Landowner associations can be private lands that are spread out through a limited entry unit that form and get permits. This year we received 28 CWMU applications. 22 of those are renewals, 6 change applications that require RAC and board approval, and then we had one that did not renew. Just as a side note, we did have a couple in the southeastern region that approached the RAC there, and we'll probably approach the board to form new CWMUs because theirs broke up in the middle of this hunt season. LOAs, we had one application. It was a change application, and then we also had one that did not renew. So first we'll talk about the CWMU program. The CWMU program was created to help incentivize and help us with depredation problems. So there's a lot of these private lands were complaining about excess wildlife on their lands. The CWMU programs helped them build a tolerance to those populations. It also gives an opportunity for the public to hunt land that they may otherwise may not be accessible to them, either for them not wanting people on their land or price-wise. And it gives them an incentive to keep their land open for wildlife. A lot of them even manage and do their habitat projects to create better habitat for wildlife to be on their land rather than developing it or using it for other purposes. As I mentioned, you do have to have, there's some contiguous acreage requirements to be a CWMU. You need 5,000 acres to be a deer or a pronghorn CWMU, and 10,000 to be a moose or elk CWMU. There are different split options. Most of the times on deer, elk, it's a 90-10 option. I have an example up here of moose, which is always a 60-40 option. So we use Weber Florence Creek as an example. They have 7 bull moose tags. So 4 of those would go to the private and 3 to the public. To give an overview of the CWMUs, you can see there's 124 CWMUs statewide. As you see it broken down by region, a majority of those are in the northern region. There's currently more than 2.2 million acres enrolled in the CWMU program. To give an overview of the permits, you can see the species there and the private and public permits. As you see, there's 2,897 private permits statewide and 444 public permits. So we'll be dealing with 2 types of CWMU applications. Renewals, which they've hit the end of their 3-year COR, so they're just re-upping on that. And then a change, which they're making a change in the course of that 3-year cycle. Most of these are dealing with permit changes. And so the next few slides, you'll see increases in green and the decreases in purple. The reason for those changes are kind of listed there. Distribution of the animals, if they have more or less animals on their CWMU, if they've added or decreased a significant amount of acreage, they're seeing more amount of quality animals or less, and the unit management objective. So we'll go over the recommendations by each region. I'm not going to touch on each one. As you kind of see here, there is a lot that have an acreage change. A lot of those are not significant acreage changes, not enough to change permits. So I will just touch on the ones that permit changes. So Grass Valley Clark Canyon is adding an additional moose permit. Royal Ivory is dropping 3. Where it says out, they've dropped moose out of the CWMU. So there's still a CWMU, just no longer for moose. Mountaintop is one that I will touch on the acreage. You see that it was 10,000 and it dropped under. So it's no longer qualifies to be an elk CWMU. So for that reason, they've dropped out of elk. Cedar Springs is adding a pronghorn tag. Jacobs Creek used to be an elk CWMU. They decided to drop out, and now they've decided that it was a good idea to be back in, so they're adding 20 there. The change applications were all in the northern region. As you see, that top one, I'll touch on the top one and the bottom three. Deseret's dropping a significant amount of pronghorn. It was a pretty hard winter up there, so they're dropping 66 pronghorn tags. The bottom three are all kind of in that same area and saw the decrease of pronghorn too, so they all dropped pronghorn out of their CWMUs. The one right above those three, Weber Florence Creek's adding 10 elk. Junction Valley, we'll touch on that one a little bit more. You see that there's a change of acreage a little bit there. 360 of those acres are actually public land that they're including to make an enforceable boundary. So that plus one permit change isn't an additional, it's not a total permit, that's an extra public permit. According to rule, if there's public land included in a CWMU, they have to compensate the public. So they'll add one additional public permit every 3 years. Southern region had Bavon Ensign, just a small acreage change. Here in the northeast, Cottonwood Ridge, no changes. Central region, Allen Ranch added a pronghorn. Deer Creek dropped 3 deer. In the southeast, Minimod is adding 5 elk. That concludes the CWMU permits, and we'll move on to the 2020 landowner associations. So landowner associations are created to build tolerance for wildlife on private lands within a limited entry unit. They need to have 50% of the total private acreage within that species habitat to form one. So they receive buck and bull permits based on the enrolled acreage and the available number of permits. So use Indian Peaks LOA as an example. So they have 909,000 elk habitat acres. In that 909,000, 28,000 of those are private acres. Of that 28,000, 24 are enrolled in the LOA. So 86% of the private land that's eligible is enrolled in the LOA. So that equals 3% of the total elk habitat. So when we give out 132 permits for it, 3% of that 132 permits would be 4. So they would qualify for 4 permits. With that being said, the Henry Mountains was the one that did not renew the application, and the Vernon had a small acreage change, not enough to change the permits. As a side note on that, it was brought to my attention that in the RAC packet, it actually said the Vernon was an elk LOA. It's actually a deer, just to make that note. And that is it. Thank you.
Thanks, Chad. Questions from the RAC? Any questions from the public?
Chad, have you been able to do any additional research on that Junction Valley addition, whether that land is at all accessible that's being added?
Yeah, it's accessible. It's a cliff area, so there's a fence on top. It's a cliffy area. You can get down in there. The biggest fear is once you get down in there and if you harvest an animal, that you're probably not coming back out that way. You're probably going to have to trespass to get out. Not impossible, but most likely.
Okay, thanks.
Any other questions from the public? Okay, I'll take comments from the RAC. But it's good. Okay. We have a few comment cards. Is Kent still here? He might not. He might have left. Kent Olson. Okay. Kevin, you're back up.
Thank you, Rack. Kevin Norman representing myself. I have a little issue with this addition of bringing in public land into this CWMU. The unit I hunt, I find this in several places, that there's fully accessible public ground that's engulfed in these CWMUs, and it doesn't sit well. I understand that in the day it was to make the boundaries easier and a little more straightforward, but with our technology these days and Onyx and everything else, I have a hard time swallowing not being able to hunt public ground inside my unit. I guarantee you some guy hunts this piece of public ground, even though it might be nasty to somebody, somebody's going to hunt it and they're going to be ticked that now they can't because their public ground got scooped up into a CWMU. So I would suggest that you do not approve that, just from a standpoint of looking what I'm looking at in my own unit, not being able to hunt. Thank you.
Thank you. Could you clarify that, Chad, to the what region is it in?
In the northern region.
And the CWM was intact, and then the only change is to add this public portion?
Yeah, so to give a little history, it was probably always incorporated that way. A lot of times those ranchers out there, they go to the fence line, right? So the fence was up on top of the cliff, so they've had the grazing that way. They've probably practiced it that way. It was never on our record books as being public land in that CWMU. With that, I was the biologist up there, so I'm pretty familiar with it. But with that in mind, I wanted to bring it through this process to make sure that it got vetted through the public process. I think it makes sense that it is a clear boundary from, you know, a fence line and a cliff line.
And so it's been used in the CWMU, this public section. Piece of land.
Yeah, and according to the operator, they don't hunt that area a lot. It's just, but that's where they've traditionally posted it.
Okay. Miles, do you want to go over the online comments?
Sure. In general, people didn't have real strong feelings on this issue statewide. 29.65% supported it, 51.98% were neutral, and 18.37% opposed. In the Northeast region, 25% support it, but 71.4% were neutral and 3.57% opposed.
Okay. Any other discussion from anyone on this topic? Okay, I would open for a motion.
I would, Mr. Chairman, I'd go ahead and make the motion that we accept the CWMU proposal as presented.
A motion from Commissioner Horrocks. Do I have a second?
I'll second that motion.
Natasha, second it. All in favor? I have 6-4 opposed. Mike, are you opposing? Okay. Do you want to state reason or you're good? Okay. That passed 6-1. Thank you. We'll move on to Lindy Carney, who's going to present the proposed rule amendments for Point Creek. Lost opportunities and equity in the hunt drawing process.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Lindy Varney. I am the licensing coordinator located in Salt Lake. So tonight I will be proposing amendments to rules that will address point creep, lost opportunities, and equity in the hunt drawing. Like right next to it. Like right this? There we go. Okay, sorry. Thought I was close enough. All right, so as the demand to hunt in Utah keeps increasing each year, and as this keeps increasing, hunters have been bringing several concerns to the division, also to your RAC members and to the board members. And some of these concerns are about point creep or lost opportunities and equity in the drawing process. So as these concerns have been brought to us, they've come into our admin section since we kind of run the drawing, and they said, they came to me since I'm the coordinator and said, what can we do to help address point creep? What can we do to address lost opportunities? So the last couple of years, the team of in wildlife came together and looked at what we could change to help address these. So the following recommendations that I'll be bringing forth tonight will help address those concerns. We all know that point creep isn't going to go away by these proposals, but they'll help reduce it. And this is just another pin in the barrel that I'm trying to put in there to help bring that number down. So first, I would like to talk to you about limited entry permits, about surrendering and reallocating them. So currently, a hunter can surrender a limited entry or a once-lifetime permit for any reason before the season opens. If they do, they get all their points reinstated and get one for the current year, and also the waiting period is waived. In 2018, 13% of our limited entry and once-in-lifetime permits were surrendered into the division. If you look at the graph on your left, this one shows you how many permits were surrendered when there was more than 30 days before the hunt started. It also shows you how many permits were reallocated back out. If you look on the graph on your right, it shows you how many permits were surrendered into the division when there was less than 30 days before the hunt started. It also shows you how many permits we were able to reallocate back out. So basically, is what this is showing you is if a permit is surrendered into the division when there's more than 30 days, it's more than likely we're able to get those permits back out. But if that permit is surrendered into us less than 30 days, we're not very successful on getting those permits back out. And the reason for this is most of these permits are surrendered into us days before the hunt starts. So we're calling hunters trying to reallocate back out, and they're telling us, I already have other obligations. I can't get work off, or basically, my wife won't let me go hunt this close to the, over the weekend. Truly, we get that one a lot. Or they don't have the funds because they weren't planning on a $400 permit. So basically, what's happened in 2018, there was 408 lost opportunities. We weren't able to get out 408 permits to other hunters. So that those permits went to waste. And those are highly coveted permits that people have been applying for years. Currently, our rule allows hunters to surrender for any reason. There's no provision on that. And these are actually examples, true examples that people have written on the surrender form. One of them is, I want a permit in a different unit, or I have too many tags this year. There's one that was lack of sheep. There was no good bulls. My guide changed jobs. And I didn't have time to scout, and I'll know I'll draw next year. Another example that I've been giving out there is we have a max point holder that's been drawing out on the Henry Mountains an illegal weapon deer hunt every year for the last 10 years. And the reason is because he's surrendering that permit every year. And he'll continue to draw this permit because he's a max point holder. He's been surrendering it a week up to the day before the hunt starts. Out of that 10 years, we've only been able to reallocate that permit twice. So eight permits have been lost on the Henrys. Another example, for this year, we had on the Zions unit for the bighorn sheep, we had the two max point holders that drew out surrender their permit the day before the hunt started. One of the reasons was my guide's not finding the quality of ram to make record, so he told me to surrender it so I can try again next year. The other guy didn't give us a reason, which we don't require them to give us a reason. Good news is we were able to get those two back out. We made it a top priority, and we did get some hunters back out on those Zion's tag. But it was still, those two max point holders will draw out next year if everything stays status quo. So because of the unintended consequences and the continue of lost opportunities for hunters, the division has the following recommendations. If you surrender at least 30 days before the season opens, we will reinstate your bonus or preference points, but you will not get a point for the current year. But we will waive the waiting period if applicable. The same benefits apply if you're in a group application. All group members must surrender their permit at least 30 days before. I want to note, this is how it currently is. It's been in this way for the last 5 years. All group members must surrender to get their points reinstated. What I'm recommending tonight is they won't get a point for the current year. Then if you surrender your permit less than 30 days before the season opens, you will lose all of your bonus or preference points. And you will not get a point for the current year. But we will waive the waiting period if applicable. This applies to group applications as well. So if some members surrender less than 30 days before the hunt starts, all group members will lose their points, but we will waive the waiting periods for those who did surrender. If a permit merits a full refund, so due to death, injury or illness, or military deployment or mobilization, if you return your permit before the season ends and you did not hunt on this permit, we are able to take that permit and surrender it and give you back your points, plus one for the current year and a refund. But what I'm proposing to you tonight is that you must submit all required forms and paperwork into the division within 90 days with the season ending. So what's happening is they're surrendering their permit due to one of those reasons, but not turning in the qualifying paperwork. So we have permits surrendered sitting on our desk, and they call us in February, oh, here's my doctor's note. Can you reinstate my points so I can apply? So it's sitting on our desk for 6 months. We just want to shorten that time frame so we can get it taken care of. If you surrender a general season permit because you accept a reallocated permit for the same species, currently you will get a refund, but it's minus the $25 handling fee. And you get your preference points reinstated. What I'm proposing tonight is you will receive a full refund. So we'll take away that handling fee and just give you the full $40 for like a general season deer permit. And we will reinstate all of your preference points, including one for the current year. So what we want to do is we want to make you whole, just like you would have drawn out in the drawing. And the same benefits apply if you're in a group. Even if the other group members don't surrender, we'll still reinstate your preference points. It's not fair to take away your points just because your group member still wants to hunt when you got a limited entry permit. So moving on from surrenders, next I want to talk about waiting periods. In Utah, the demand to hunt is increasing. Our applications have been going up by at least 5% over the last few years for limited entry deer and limited entry elk. The odds for drawing out for one of these permits is keeps going up each year. So for deer, this year it was 1 in 45. So you got to remember, this is statewide, all weapon types. So we just took the number and put them all together. If you get into different weapons and units, it definitely can be higher. For limited entry bull elk, it's 1 in 33. The purpose of a waiting period, so if you draw out on a limited entry permit, you currently get a waiting period. And the purpose is to keep successful applicants out of the drawing for a few years. And the reason why is because we want to give other hunters a better chance of drawing a permit. So with the demand increasing each year, the division is recommending a 5-year waiting period for limited entry buck deer. This is the same as limited entry bull elk. This is more equitable and will also give other applicants a better chance to draw out on a limited entry deer permit. We've also seen an increase in applications for our general season permits. Like Kobe mentioned earlier, we had over 160,000 applicants this year for a general season deer permit. And that keeps going up. So the overall odds for drawing out for a general season deer is 1 in 2. Remember, that's statewide, all across all weapon types. If you start getting into any legal weapon hunts, it can be 1 in 3 or 1 in 4. And then for our general season antlerless hunts, it's 1 in 5. And that also can vary depending on the unit you apply for. It can be higher. However, sometimes we do have leftover permits out of these drawings, and we also do sell additional opportunities over the counter, and those usually are in July when those go on sale. Right now, hunters that buy those over-the-counter permits don't lose their preference points for that species. So with that, the division recommends the following. Preference points will be forfeited for any purchases over for the following hunts or permits: general season buck deer, antlerless elk, doe pronghorn, sandhill crane, sharp-tail grouse, greater sage grouse, and swan. However, preference points will not be forfeited or any purchase of the following hunts or permits: youth, archery, general season buck deer permits. These are the ones that go over the counter in July. They're above and beyond what went through the drawing. We didn't feel like we wanted to penalize the youth for going out and hunting on one of these permits. The next one is the mitigation permits issued to landowners, and then the antlerless control permits. Now, just for a little clarification on this, it's based on species and sex. So if you get a general season buck tag, you lose the general season preference points for a buck deer. If you get a doe, it's doe points. It's based on species and sex. So, like I said, our applications are keep increasing, and we in our admin section get a lot of complaints about, I want a tag every year. The most complaints I get from the governor's office is on general season permits. Shockingly, you would think it would be limited entry because it takes so long to draw out on one. But it's the general season deer hunts, because we kind of have that expectation of limited entry hunters. They know it's going to take a handful of years. But general season deer, they think they can get one every year. In most units, you can, but there are handfuls that it does take several years. And so the division has been directed to look for ways to give more opportunity to hunters more often. So this is one of those opportunities that we found. In 2019, 71% of our dedicated hunter applicants also applied for a general season buck deer permit. Now, these two programs, program and a hunt, come out of the same quota. So this essentially gave these applicants two opportunities to obtain a general season buck deer permit. And when looking into this, in 2019, if we didn't allow the hunters to apply for both, 1,000 so-ish permits would have been offered to someone else in the regular general season draw. So 1,000 permits were taken by dedicated hunters that applied as it for dedicated hunter COR and general season. So because of this, and looking for more opportunity to allow hunters to hunt more often, the division recommends to allow hunters to apply for a general season buck deer permit or the dedicated hunter program, but not both. Moving on to management buck deer. This hunt began in 2009 as an any legal weapon hunt on the Henrys and the Ponsagon units. At that time, it was approved to allocate 30% of the permits to the youth, 30% of the permits to anyone who's 65 and older, and 40% of the permits to everyone else. Over the year, these hunts have been divided up into different weapon types. So now we have archery, muzzleloader, and any legal weapon muzzleloader hunts. And what's happening is, with those three weapon types, that quota is divided up into now the three hunts. And so applicants are applying in February for these as a youth, thinking that they have 30% of the quota allocated to them. And that's not the case anymore. On one unit, in particular, an archery hunt, we only offered two permits total. So we weren't able to allocate 30% to the youth and to who are 65 and older. So they applied under the assumption that they actually had quota allocated to them. And so we kind of applied under false hope. So with that, the division recommends removing that permit quota allocated to the youth and to those who are 65 and older. Moving on to variances. A little bit of history on a variance. Sometimes hunters can't obtain or use their permit because of events or conditions that are out of their control, such as injury or illness to the permit holder, injury, illness, or death to immediate family member, or military deployment or mobilization. In these cases, the division has two options to help these hunters out. The first option is we're able to restore bonus or preference points and waive the waiting period for the following types of permits: general season, limited entry, public CWMU, and once-in-a-lifetime permits. The second option we have is we can grant a season extension to the same hunt or similar hunt into the next year for the following types of permits: once in a lifetime, conservation, private limited entry landowner, poacher and reported reward permits, and the private CWMU permits. Currently, no variance option exists for the Wildlife Expo permit holders. As I've taken the role on as the licensing coordinator, I've noticed over the years that some hunters that have been approved for a season extension keep applying for one year after year and get approved because they have the same health condition that's preventing them from hunting. And some of these are dating back to 2015. So what's happening is they're rolling that permit over and over and over again. We actually approved one that will go into 2020 that was a 2015 tag. So this hunt's been going on for 5 years that this hunter is unable to do because of health conditions. So this has raised some concerns within the division, such as this could put more hunters into the field than anticipated. Like I mentioned in the slide before, these are once-in-a-lifetime permits or conservation permits where we don't have a whole lot of hunters on the landscape. So adding another hunter or two can make an effect on pressure or crowding issues. And also the other concern, this could affect the over or under harvest for that year, which then can affect biologists' recommendations. Because of those, here are the following amendments the division is recommending to the variance rule: to allow the Wildlife Expo permit holders a variance option that will extend their season to the following year. The next one is a one-time season extension only for permits obtained through a DWR drawing, and a maximum 2-year season extension for permit holders of a conservation permit, a private CWMU permit, or the Limited Entry Landowner Association permit. And the reason for the difference, I want to take a second and explain the reason why if it's a drawing permit, it's a 1 year, versus if it's a purchase voucher, it's a 2-year, is because if you draw one through the drawing, you've used points and you've paid for this permit, just the permit fee. And if it goes on for another year, your health condition, we have a rule in place where we can still reinstate those points and get you a refund if you qualify. So we have a way to still help you out. On the 2-year season extension for those conservation and private CWMU permits, is we don't have a way to make those hunters whole. We don't, you know, refund them what they paid for that voucher to the organizations. So we're giving them 2 years to take care of their health condition. And that's the reason why for the difference between the two. Moving on to surrendering private vouchers. And sometimes hunters purchase and then redeem their voucher for conservation, limited entry landowner, or a CWMU hunt, and then can't use it for one of the following reasons: death of the permit holder, injury or illness, military deployment or mobilization, or there was an error issuing the permit. That's usually if the division accidentally issued it to the wrong person, so we miskeyed it. And the variance or the refund rule doesn't provide an adequate surrender option for these hunters. So the division is recommending to provide the conservation permit holders and the limited entry landowner voucher holders the same permit surrender option that is already provided to a private CWMU voucher holder. So what that means is if you purchase a conservation voucher and you redeem it into a permit and one of those conditions I just listed happens, we can take that permit and turn it back into a voucher so you can have a family member use it instead, which we already do this for CWMU, so we just wanted to add conservation and the LOAs to that category to give them that capability. I know that that's a lot of recommendations that I'm making tonight. There's like 16. So I'm just going to take a quick summary to go over all of them for you. So we'll start off with surrenders. So if you surrender a permit at least 30 days before the season opens, your previous acquired bonus or preference points will be reinstated, and the waiting period will be waived if applicable. If you surrender a permit less than 30 days before the season opens, you will lose your bonus or preference points, but the waiting period will be waived if applicable. You must submit all required forms and paperwork within 90 days of the season ending to qualify for the full refund. You will receive a full refund for your general season permit and have all of your preference points reinstated, plus one for the current year, if you accept a reallocated permit for the same species. The waiting period for a limited entry buck deer will increase to 5 years. You will forfeit your preference points for almost any over-the-counter purchase, with a few exceptions. You can apply for a general season buck deer permit or the dedicated hunter program, but not both. Remove the permit permit quota allocated to the youth and to those who are 65 and older on the management buck deer hunts. If you draw a wildlife expo permit, you can request a variance that will extend that hunt to the next year. If you obtain a permit through a DWR drawing, there is a 1 year limit on a season extension through the variance. If you obtain a conservation permit, CWMU permit, that's purchased through an operator, or a limited entry landowner association permit, there's a 2 year maximum on a season extension if you apply for a variance. Conservation permit holders and limited entry landowner voucher holders will have the same permit surrender options that's already provided to our private CWMU voucher holders. Then last but not least is just a few housekeeping recommendations. These will help improve the overall customer experience when applying in the drawings. The first one is to allow group applications for points. The next one is to allow the division to establish time periods for applicants to withdraw, modify, or edit their application. So what this one is, this will, if this language is approved, this will give the division the capability to now start working with the contractor to allow hunters to go in and modify their application instead of having to withdraw and then resubmit their app if they made an error. This wouldn't go into effect for the 2020 big game application. This would probably be a year down the road, but with this language, this would give us the capability to move forward with that concept. Next one is to allow up to 4 youth to apply together in a group for the youth any bull elk hunt. And then last is to clarify that you can only draw one once-in-lifetime permit in the same year, in the big game drawing and in the sportsman's drawing. That's how it currently is. That's how it's been since this began, but we felt like we needed to just make that a little bit more clear in the rule that you can't have 2 once-in-a-lifetime draw permits. And that's it. Thank you.
Thanks, Lindy. Maybe I'll ask a few questions to start. On group forfeitures, if one person in the group has a illness or something, can the other 3 people in the group just continue with the hunt and you just work with the one?
Yes, we can. If it's due to a death or ill or injury, we kind of treat it as a separate application, and okay, we can take care of that hunter and get his points reinstated.
And so the group can stay with,
correct,
their tags. And I had one other question. The one where you had to forfeit by the end of the season, so theoretically someone could hunt almost a whole season and then forfeit their tag at the last day?
Well, it says that you can. You can't hunt the whole season. You only can do that if you don't hunt. That's actually in statute, so we can't change that. But they have up to the last day of the season end to surrender their permit if they were ill or injured or death occurred. As long as they testify that they did not hunt, they have to sign a written statement saying they didn't hunt.
Okay. So not because they were sick of hunting.
No, not because they're sick of hunting.
Okay.
They actually they're sick and was unable to go out.
Okay. Questions from the rack?
How do you get on the call list?
For surrenders?
Yeah, when you're looking for that extra person to take a tag.
We use the alternate list. So it's a list that everyone that applies for that hunt, we use the lowest draw number. So if we would have had a permit, another additional list, who would have drawn out? So it's just a generated list that... lowest drawn numbers.
We just can't volunteer to be on that list?
Nope. Do by applying.
Jamie?
So the part where you're saying you're surrendering within 30 days, are there any exceptions to that? Like you're saying the death, illness, injury.
Yeah, if it is death, ill, or injured, or military, we'll take care of those hunters and reinstate their points, including one for the current year, if they qualify for those reasons.
All right, thank you.
You're right. A comment that, I apply for 6, 7, 8 Western states, and Utah, even with these rule changes, is still the most friendly state that I am aware of in returning your permits, you know what I'm saying, even with these rule changes. And I like where you're going with that, because, for our application fees and what we do, Utah is a very friendly state compared to the other Western states.
Thank you.
I have one more question. Private lands, elk tags, are they similar to control tags, or are they over in the you lose your point category?
They're in the lose your point category.
Okay.
Thank you.
Is there any questions from the public? And this is not your comments, but you're welcome to ask questions.
J.C. Brewer, I just wanted a clarification on that waiting period change on deer.
Mm-hmm.
Deer going from 2 years to 5-year waiting period, assuming that I had a deer tag 2 years ago. I waited 2 years. Now, do I have to wait 3 more, or does that start this year?
It would start in 2020.
Start in 2020.
Yes, it would go starting going forward in 2020. So okay. People that drew before then would not be affected.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, I had one question, if that's okay.
Go ahead, Dan.
In your exception, there's not really anything stated that the division could be lenient on. So you pretty much have to meet those 3 criteria. Is that correct?
That is correct. Those are the 3 criteria listed in statute.
So what's the process to change that? Is statute going to get changed with some of these recommendations tonight?
Are you talking about for the lose your points?
Any of this?
No, none of this is getting changed in statute. Some of this is driven by where we can't change it because of statute. So some of the reasons?
The reason I ask is, especially, boom and bust towns like you're in now, sometimes people have to take work assignments on short notice, and considerable, if it's, valid and proven that it come up within that 30-day window that they've been denied the vacation because they've had to go work out of state, out of country, or things of that nature, if that's been a consideration, or what process would it take to get that ran through?
The way it's written, it would be denied. You would lose your points, but you would waive the waiting period.
Daniel, to change that, you'd have to do it legislatively?
No, to change that, that would just be rule for something like that. I thought it meant for something different.
Well, you just said it was written in legislature.
Yeah, legislated I thought you meant something different.
So that could take place through this process.
Exactly that, yeah, through the public process. But just to be aware that it would be like documentation for work. It could get kind of admin heavy, but I get what you're saying. Because some people can't work, some people have other obligations that would come up too. You have to kind of think of it as a whole.
So on a criteria, I sprain my ankle and get a doctor's note. I could get that variance?
You could get, yeah. If it's got proper documentation, you have to get a doctor's statement saying what day it occurred on, couldn't it happen 3 months ago?
Thank you.
Huh? Kick in the leg.
Okay, is there any comments from the RAC? Question?
Yeah.
Okay, step back up.
Yeah, Lindy, Blake Bass, represent Dedicated Hunter and Sportsman. The division's a business and it likes revenue. Has the division took in consideration the amount of revenue lost on the 70% of dedicated hunters that apply second choice as a general season tag?
We have. If this went through, because we would lose those applications, that wasn't a concern for the division.
Can you explain that? Aren't they guaranteed a tag. They're not guaranteed a tag as a dedicated hunter?
No, you still have to apply for the COR.
Okay.
And then once you draw out that COR, then you get a permit for the 3 years.
Okay. Would you like to make a comment?
Yes, sir.
Please state your name.
Hi. My name's Nolan Massey, and I'm basically here. I did a card, but so you asked for comment from...
You can go ahead and do your comment and your question right now.
Okay. So I'm here just basically as myself, not representing anybody except for the people in the future that may need to surrender a tag, right? So, Lindsay, excuse me, I need to get closer. Can you pull up your slide to the chart graph on how many people... Like, they had 600, I think, on there, 600 people that surrendered their tag. How many of them are limited entry or once in a lifetime?
These are all limited entry.
This
doesn't include general season permits.
So, yeah.
It's almost 800 permits that were brought
basically,
in.
And I'm here to oppose the rule or, I get nervous in front of the crowd, right? But... to oppose the change in the permit surrender. Just leave it as it is. It's pretty good, pretty friendly. Utah is friendly in that respect. And we had to surrender a tag. And, so if we would have followed these rules, we'd have lost 23 points, right? And, how about on the once-in-a-lifetime, big-time things, go to 48 hours prior to instead of 30 days?
It still wouldn't be enough time.
How about notifying the alternates in advance that they possibly could end up with a tag in their lap?
That would be a lot of people to contact because we just don't know what permits are going to be brought in.
I mean,
and really everyone, it's possible that could be called. If you apply for that hunt, you could be called.
But you already know who the alternates are.
Yeah, every single person that applies for the hunt is an alternate.
Oh. Okay. I thought they had them if you give 5 tags, there was 2 or 3 alternates.
No. Every single person that applies has a draw number. Right.
That's my misconception. But anyway... they only had 600, roughly 600 tags exchanged and 50% reallocation. So what's wrong with that? And plus they got to keep the money from the ones that surrendered the tag for the most part, probably, right?
On the ones that are less than 30 days, you don't get a refund. But it's a lost opportunity. It's 408 permits that we weren't able to get back out and
reallocate
back out. And that was in each year, as you can see, this has 3 years. Each year it's increasing. So in 2018 we had almost 800 permits surrendered. Was this? I already know this year's more.
Yeah.
I don't have 2019 because the hunts are still going, but I know it's higher than last year.
Well, so I'm here to say that under the new rules, we would have lost 22 points. And for, surrendering the tag. And I would like to see the board oppose this rule change. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Blake, did you make a comment, or do you still have a comment?
I think Blake Best, dedicated hunter. I have 5 general season deer points, and basically with this rule change, to me, they are worthless. I wasted my money acquiring them because I will always put in as dedicated hunter. I believe that the division is losing revenue over this situation because this year going in, re-putting in for my dedicated hunter, I could also put in as a general season with my 5 points that I have, and they would get my $10. They're losing a lot of money, and I don't think it's fair to the dedicated hunter that puts in a lot of time and effort and good sportsmen out there do a lot of the division's projects. I don't think it's being fair to the dedicated hunter not being able to put in general season second choice. I would like to encourage the RAC to disregard the division's recommendation of not being able to apply second choice for general season. There are several thousand other dedicated hunters like myself that their general season bonus points that we've paid money for and acquired are basically worthless if we put in first choice dedicated hunter. Thank you.
Thank you, Blake. Kevin?
Sharon Massey. On your 800, what's the percentage that you refund back? Do you refund back all of those? Do they all go through that process?
The one that's surrendered more than 30 days, get a refund minus 25.
Okay, so, but the ones that you've done now, have you refunded all of these 800?
No, we did not refund, because the ones that were surrendered less than 30 days, so it's about, what, 370-ish, 380, were not refunded.
So, see, I recommend that that's wrong, because I'm the one who surrendered her tag this year, of 22 years, for injuries, but I did it within 3 weeks. I missed her 30 days, but I waived my $500 because, you know, but life happens. I mean, not all of us are the guy that drew 10 times and turns it back. He has an ulterior motive for that. For me, that would be a punishment. 23 years is a long time to wait to draw out a tag. I mean, that's kind of wishy-washy. And yes, you do work with us. The ladies here at the local office were awesome. I mean, I filled out the right paperwork, and I sent it in like I was supposed to. I returned everything, but there's got to be some... I mean, I get this, that you don't get to resell it or you don't get to reallocate it, but these are once-in-a-lifetime hunts. Yeah, that's a lot. You got to really think about that before you pass it, because... And I get where you're coming, there's 800, but how many of those are the one guy or the one off where his wife doesn't let him hunt? Well, lose your points for those, yes. But injuries and whatnot, they happen.
Can I clarify? If it is an injury, we'll take care of you. We'll reinstate your points and refund.
I know, but if you do this...
Those aren't included in this.
Those are not?
No, if you surrender the day before the hunt starts because of injury, or the day before the hunt ends because of injury, we'll take care of you. I'm not changing that rule. These are the ones that are surrendering the day before the hunt starts for random reasons, not because
not
they got
medical
injured.
And not, okay.
Yeah, not because of medical or death.
Okay.
Kevin Norman representing SFW. Lindy, thank you so much for your hard work on this. SFW supports the division's recommendations with the one exception that, kind of like this gentleman, our committee feels that so many things have been slowly taken away from the dedicated hunters, and it's such a valuable program that we run the risk of it not being appealing anymore, and this being one of them. So SFW accepts the recommendations with that exception of believing we should still be able to apply for the general and the dedicated, as we previously had. Speaking for myself, I think Lindy's got a tough job at pulling the Band-Aid off here. The system's just been used and abused, and I think it's safe to say that the majority of these tags being turned back are max points guys that are just shopping deer. It's kind of taking the hunt out of the hunt, and they don't see what they want the day before, so they turn it back. And it's the harsh reality that, you know, if you draw the tag, you've got to go make the best of it and not rob 400 people of that opportunity because you didn't find the deer that you're open for. So thank you, Lindy. We support you 100%. Thank you.
Thank you. We have more discussion.
I've got one. Go ahead. Mine,
you're up.
I support the division's recommendations. I think we need to look at the dedicated hunter thing a little bit. But I was contacted by Farm Bureau 30 minutes before this meeting started, and they apologized they wasn't able to get a letter out for the racks, but they will have a letter to the state board, apparently, before that meeting. Their concern is on landowner tags, landowners that receive vouchers, they lose their points and their opportunity to hunt other hunts. Is that correct under this proposal?
Depends on which one you're talking about. So we have, if it's the fee vouchers, then yes, whoever purchases those permits would lose their points. But if it's the free ones that are used for depredation purposes, they don't lose the points.
Okay, I think Farm Bureau maybe is misunderstanding it.
And then we also offer landowner appreciation permits and then just landowner permits.
So on the landowner appreciation permits, they will not lose
those ones you would.
Okay, that's the ones they were talking about. And so their thought is, so they gave me an example, a guy in the Tinnick unit receives the landowner appreciation. He likes to hunt the Nebo unit, which is every 3 years, I guess, approximately. Their feeling is if that's a landowner appreciation permit, and that can go to, so he, if I understood correctly, he can sell that permit or he can give it to a family member or something. Is that correct?
He can't sell it. It's what, immediate family, Ovi?
Okay.
It's different for each program. It depends on the program.
Oh, okay.
It gets kind of confusing. You want Kobe to explain? He knows it a lot better because he helped develop.
Yeah, I apologize. Yeah.
He can't sell it.
But he can give it to a family member.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. And so for the landowner appreciation permits, those are only the landowner. For the landowner permits, for every 640 acres that they own in a unit, they get a permit.
Okay.
And that can go to a family member, and that can go to a landowner or a lessee.
Okay.
Yep.
So they were talking about the landowner appreciation ones then, apparently.
Probably both the landowner and the landowner appreciation ones, I assume. Those are both buck deer programs.
Okay. So they, I guess they lose their opportunity to hunt another unit if they accept that permit. And they don't want to kill two animals in the same year. They just don't want to be locked in to have to hunt their specific deal if that's an appreciation tag for allowing wildlife depredation, mitigation, or, you know, depredation, then their feeling is these landowners should be able to, if they don't, you know, they're not going to use that appreciation tag themselves, they should still be able to hunt these other units. Which I can understand. I mean, you know, is it an appreciation tag or is it their hunting tag?
Go ahead, Cody.
Okay, so from the division's perspective, and I understand what you're saying, Richie, but from the division's perspective, the appreciation part is they get to skip the line, right? Rest of us have to wait to draw and wait many years to draw time, sometimes 3 years. But if you own property inside the Nebo unit, 100 acres of ag, you get to put in, you skip the line. If you want to do that every year, you can. Now, I understand that if you own property in another unit but like to hunt a different unit, you have to choose, but you still get to choose. And your son could draw that permit or another family member could draw that permit. And if you really want to hunt another unit, you get to hunt the whole unit on the Nebo. And with these permits, they're not limited to their private land. They're allowed to hunt the whole unit. So what we're really facing is that we have 160,000 applications for deer. We have 90,000 opportunities. We're trying to balance that. And what that means is that everybody, under Lindy's proposal, if you look at it holistically, we can all think of reasons why we don't like one thing or another. But if we exempt everything, we accomplish nothing. And that's why we presented it the way we did.
Thank you. I think one of their concerns, too, is that maybe the division has put in a lot of effort to encourage landowners to allow wildlife habitat and usage. Also, that it may discourage that, you know, because if they're going to choose, if they want to hunt another unit and they're not going to accept the appreciation tag, they lose a little bit of incentive there. But tell you the truth, I'm going to let the Farm Bureau, because I didn't have a lot of notice of their concern, I'm going to let them address that further in, with the state board. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Daniel, did you have a comment?
Yeah, so I'd go back to them variance approvals for forfeiture, and I really have a hard time with, you know, work-related issues, because that is our livelihood. If it wasn't for that, we couldn't go play. It gets in the way sometimes, unfortunately, but I think there's ways for proof on that, and I feel that, you know, when it comes to work-related issues on being reassigned or sent to a different area during that time frame, that you shouldn't be punished for it, because you're not going to quit your job. That's just the side note. But when you put in for 15 years, you know, it's a big investment. But another concern I had was along the same lines as the dedicated hunter. A little on the fence about some things there, because being able to apply for both, I too have 4 or 5 general season points, and I'm a dedicated hunter. Next year, I'm guaranteed a general season permit. So in a 4-year period, I'm killing 3 deer, so I get a little more opportunity. It's a general season opportunity. I put in my time. I dedicate everything to it. Lindy, is the division opposed to putting those under the same drawing, to where I have a choice to either draw dedicated or general season and combine those points?
We're not opposed to the idea. We're kind of opposed to combining the points. That becomes more of a legal issue than anything, because, you know, preference points for dedicated and general season are a little different. If that's the route you guys are thinking about going, it's an idea that we're worth looking into. It couldn't be for 2020, just because of we got to notify the public of that big of a change. Especially, let me start over. So we can change the programming so you can put those both into one application, where you apply for dedicated hunters, your first choice. Your second choice can be a rifle tag, third choice muzzleloader. We can do that. But what I've been advised through our attorney is that we would have to notify the public by at least a year or two and tell them that, hey, this kind of program's changing. Use your dedicated hunter points. And then moving forward after a certain date, this is how it's going to work. I was advised that's the best way for the public to do that kind of big of a change. So if that's something that you want, then, you know, make a motion for me to look into it and then come back with a recommendation. And then, but it couldn't be for 2020, it'd be more like 2021-ish.
So this is, these recommendations don't fall in, say, like a management plan where it's a cyclical time frame. You're only going to come around every 3 years.
No, mine are more social issues. I'm not, you know, if something needs to be changed, then I can come out every month and see you guys.
So, can I get some clarification for myself, the difference between the points of general season and dedicated, whether preference, bonus? I was under the understanding they're
both
all preference.
They are both preference, but you have dedicated hunter preference points and general season buck deer preference points, because it's 2 separate applications. So you can accumulate a point for each, because they're 2 different things. So when you apply in the big game drawing, you can go in and submit an application for a dedicated hunter COR. Pay the $10 application fee, and then your next application, you can apply for a general season hunt, pay the $10, and if you're not successful on either of those, you'll get a point for dedicated hunter and general. So it's 2 different programs, but using the same quota.
So with that said, to me, it would make more sense if that was more appealing to the public, that we leave it as it is instead of a change this year and then a change again next year. That's from the feedback that everybody has and the concerns over the dedicated hunter. That's kind of my stance on it, is if there is a better way to potentially do it through this public process that's come forward, that we don't touch it. Leave it as is, apply for both, and then look at combining those.
But I think that's an option to make that recommendation.
So that's
they're actually getting to play two pools. And those of us who are not dedicated hunters just get one, right?
Correct. That's how it currently is. They have two opportunities.
They miss that point. They got a pretty sweet deal.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I just want one comment, and then I'll shut up. The private lands elk tags are very similar to the control tags. They're used as a management tool, specifically in the Northeast region. And it will probably tie the hands of the biologists if you take away points on the private lands tags, because there's really no difference between a control tag and a private lands tag in its purpose. Different area, same elk management unit. Would you like to address that, Randall? Or do you agree with that statement?
I think before we need to clarify that it's Kobe Jones. Yes. I'm sorry, I'm Kobe Jones. I think before we need to clarify that it's the division's recommendation that those do take points. So the recommendation from the division is that they do take points.
Just on the private lands, but not on the control.
Just on the private lands, but not on the control. And the rationale behind that is, and Lindy can pull up the data, but it's what I said before. We do want to address elk on private lands, and we also want to allow people to hunt. If we keep exempting things, if we exempt this and land or buck deer permits and everything else, it's still a choice. It's all a choice. And if we exempt everything, we don't address point creep. And Lindy has some extra data she could show the RAC if they wanted to see of what that means on over-the-counter elk sales. It's big.
Okay.
If you want to see it, Tanya's got to come along.
All right. We can just move on then. Do you want to move on or do you want to comment, Randall?
Okay. Do you want to see it?
No. We're going to just move on. Do you want to address the
sure.
statewide?
The statewide electronic comments, 53.24% of the folks supported the proposal. 23.5% were neutral, 23% opposed. In the Northeast region, was quite similar, 53.5% support. 14.3% were neutral and 32.1% opposed.
Okay, I'd like to move this along if we can. I think we've at least brought to attention all the issues. Hopefully we can come up with a motion that addresses the way we want to go.
Yeah, Randy, I have a question.
Okay.
Or excuse me, Brett, sorry.
You can ask Randy.
Sorry, Randy.
He's right there.
So you should asking Randy for permission to talk. Hey, so this debate that we're having over the proposed change to only be able to put in for dedicated hunter or general season, was this an issue statewide, Lindy? And if so, was there a consensus on how to deal with this?
It kind of overall, like, it's been a discussion at every region, the dedicated hunter versus general season, but the consensus is they've been approving the concept except for central. They kind of went with, they'll approve it, but they want me to come back to them later with kind of like combine it into one application. So they approved to only allow them to apply for one, but come back with a night of how we would combine them into one draw. The rest of the regions, it's been like you guys, you know, talking about it, figuring out what it means, and a lot of people are passionate about it. But in the end, they've been approving it.
But it seems like what's in jeopardy are the preference points, and how are they? Is that just something that if we approve it, then those who had, you know, four or five preference points for a general season, or, you know, a couple preference points for a dedicated hunter application, they, you know, they
get. These have to make the choice of what one they want to apply for. They won't; those points won't go away. They need to make the choice. Do they want to be in the dedicated hunter program, or do they want to apply for the general season, you know, unit?
Yeah.
So it's a choice.
But if they draw on
if they
one,
draw,
it will not take the points from the other.
No, they will just lose the points from the program they drew from.
Yeah, and I guess my feeling is that it seems like the state is doing everything they can to increase opportunity, you know, in many different ways. And this is just an example of taking a little bit of an opportunity away. And I think another comment, too, is that it seems like, I'm not sure who made this, but somebody made this comment earlier, the state is really trying to accommodate, you know, protecting, you know, hunters who have things that come up, you know, as far as reinstating points and refunds and things like that. It seems like the state's really conscientious of doing that, so that's good.
I have one more question. With this dedicated hunter or general season, them having to pick, have you guys run any statistics on how many more opportunities that would?
It would have been almost 1,000 permits this year if they had to pick. 1,000 more permits would have gone through. Well, would have given another hunter a tag. Does that make sense? So.
Okay, I'm going to open it up for a motion.
Mr. Chair, can I make a couple smaller motions?
Yes, we can break that.
If
that's the best way to handle it, we can break it up.
Keep track of everything in better detail, hopefully. So I would like to make a motion to leave the dedicated hunter as it is currently. And to have the division / Lindy look at combining the dedicated hunter with the general season system, and in doing so would eliminate the confusion of a change year after year after year.
So what I heard was the proposal as is, with the exception of the dedicated hunter, private, and general season draw.
I was just making a motion to address dedicated hunter portion of that only.
You have other motions?
Yes. If you'd like it all inclusive, I can keep going, Mr. Chair.
How many is there?
One more.
One more?
Yes.
Yeah, let's just go with the next. Let's hear the next one.
And on the division variances, to include employment issues within that 30-day window for variances?
Prior to the 30 days?
After the 30 days.
After window. The 30, closer, up to this, up to the hunt.
Correct.
Okay, so if I could clarify the motion, it's as presented, with the exception of the dedicated hunter, and to add a variance for work-related reasons that they will not be able to use their tag. Is that accurate, Daniel?
That's correct, yes.
Okay.
Can I have you change one word? Not use variance, but use like an exception, because variance to the division means something different than what you're meaning it as. So this would be an exception to, if you surrender due to work, it wouldn't go through. When we say variance, it goes through a different process.
Okay.
So that's it.
Thank you.
Okay. So we have a motion on the table. Do I have a second? Okay, we do not have a second. Does anyone have a substitute motion?
I would like to make a motion that we accept the division's recommendations as it was presented tonight.
We have a new motion on the table to accept it as presented. Do we have a second?
Can I amend that motion, Brett?
Okay.
I think there's some credence to what Daniel is saying, especially in our area right now with our economy and our work situation and guys getting sent out of town a lot. And we have a lot of very avid hunters here. So I would like to amend Commissioner Horrocks's motion and amend that the division does take a look at, what was the word you used, Lindy?
Exceptions.
To make an exception on those draws for work issues. It may be administratively heavy, but I think that's okay. I think just because that's a pretty pertinent issue to our area and our situation right now.
That sounds like what I said.
Are you okay
yeah,
with that?
I'm okay.
Okay. So we have, whether it's an amended motion, we have a new motion on the table. Let's just say the second motion failed for lack of a second. We now have a new motion as presented with the exception for work-related reasons.
I'll second it.
We have a second on that. All in favor? Unanimous. Thank you. Thank you, Lindy, for all your explanation on that. You earned extra pay to whoever you work for.
There we go.
You have the next topic. Lindy will address the timeline. And that will, on this Castle Valley one, it says action, but we don't do it, right?
We're ready. Okay. I just want to point out this is an informational item. So rack and board to educate and to explore different ideas about the big game application timeline. So tonight I'll be kind of going through that with you guys. So first I'm going to start off going over with you how the application currently works and the timing and the dates. So it is open for 7 weeks. The first 5 weeks of the application, you can apply for hunts, points. The application always opens up the last Thursday in January. And it closes for hunt applications the first Thursday in March. And then it closes altogether the third Thursday in March. And then results are always posted by May 31st. This structure has been in place for a handful of years, I think 5 or 6 years now. Before that, it was always like the first part of January. Like I mentioned, the Wildlife Board asked me to bring the informational out because we've been hearing concerns. There's been a lot of social issues going on that the RACs have been hearing, the public's been bringing to you guys and bringing to the board, and also to the division. We're getting the same calls as you guys are, and mainly because people are applying without knowing what the exact quota is. And also because what I want to do tonight is kind of explain to you what the process is. What it takes to open a draw, what's going on during the application period while you guys are applying, what the division is doing internal for the application, and then what's going on after the application closes, and then what it takes to actually finalize the big game application, to finalize the draw. So I'm going to start with November 30th to December 30th. Our hunts are ending, and the hunters have 30 days to submit their harvest survey. So we kind of wait till the end of all the hunts to gather that data. So from December 31st to January 31st, the division, sorry, this is really small. Hold on one second. So the division gathers the harvest and age data, and all a contractor, and they analyze that to us. And they have to be sent back to us by the 31st of January. The big game application period is open from January 30th through March 19th. February 2nd through March 4th, the age and harvest data is analyzed in our Salt Lake office by some of our biologists. And then they send that out to the biologists in the regions, and the regional biologist reviews that harvest, their classifications, and the age data so they can make their recommendations and submit them to the regional supervisor. From March 2nd to March 15th, the big game coordinator reviews all the recommendations from the regions. So right now that's sent to COVI, and COVI reviews all of it and compiles it together. From March 16th through March 20th, the big game coordinator meets with our director's office, and they go over the proposals and gather and get approval from them. From March 20th to April 30th, the draw contractor is reviewing all applications for errors, duplicate application, revocations, dedicated hunter applications, and lifetime applications. So what that means, so this year in 2019, we had over 500,000 applications. So during that month, what we're doing is they're using a computer-generated system to compare applications together. They look for similar characteristics that may be the same person. And it's something to look at it personally and see if it is fraud. Sometimes they are. People like to try to apply twice so they can have another opportunity to get a permit. We're also looking for duplicate apps. There's always, it's a computer. Sometimes, you know, duplicate apps happen for various reasons. And then we do revocations. So when you apply, we look at the compact to see if anyone's on revocation, but people sometimes get put on revocation during the application period. And so they'll submit their application, you know, March 1st, and their revocation starts on March 15th. And we'll still go through those applications and see who's on revocation to remove those applicants. We don't want anyone that can't have a tag draw out. And so we'll do that to make sure we get as much as out as possible. And then when I say we submit dedicated hunter and lifetime apps, what we're doing is taking the dedicated hunters that are in their second and third year, we're taking how many they are, we're putting it into the system, because dedicated hunters only take up 15% of the quota. So we're just getting that prepped so when we run the draw. And then lifetime license holders aren't required to submit an application during that time frame. If they want their permit they've been having year after year, we'll automatically mail them one out, but we have to manually submit an application for them. So we're doing that during that time frame. On March 24th, we have an internal meeting within the division. We call it the brown bag. That's where we review all these lovely presentations that you guys get to see. We want to make sure that it flows and that what we're recommending is what we're really saying to you guys. From April 1st to April 30th, the draw contractor implements and tests programming changes to the draw. As we all know, things are never consistent or constant, so changes are made, percentages of how many permits are getting allocated to this or that. So they like to use live data. They like to use that 515,000 apps to make sure it can handle that 500,000 applications. So they like to use that, and they're testing it to make sure it will work when we actually push the button. From April 7th through the 16th is the RAC meetings. And that's when the division brings forth all of our permit recommendations to you guys. April 30th is the Wildlife Board meeting. And that's where the Wildlife Board will go over all of your recommendations that the RACs bring forth, all the motions, and make final approvals. From May 1st to May 4th, the division reviews all the permit quotas that are approved by the Wildlife Board. As we all know, what we present to the RAC meetings isn't what's always approved by the Wildlife Board in the end. So we have a committee in place to review and make sure those are accurate, that the changes are made so we issue the correct quota through the draw. on May 4th, the licensing section will submit that the quotas to the draw contractor. On May 5th and 6th, the draw contractor programs the quota into the program, into the sequence. So they'll take all the quotas, type them in, put them in to make sure that's how many permits are going on a certain unit. And then May 6th, they'll send that back to my licensing team, and we will review that, make sure that it is accurate, make sure the right numbers typed in, make sure it wasn't miskeyed or there's an error. And then from May 6th to May 31st, we run the draw. So hard to believe, it actually takes about 7 days to run the draw. Once we push that button, the computer's running almost 7 days straight because of the volume of applications that we have and all the different exceptions to the rules. You know, an allocation here, 20% there, 15 here. It takes time. But once that happens, that is sent back to the licensing section. By each hunt number, we will review and make sure that quota is accurate. We want to make sure that everything, another check. We just want to double check everything, triple check, make sure we have that quota correct. So we'll make sure the programming was accurate in percentages. And then once we approve that, let me point out, we don't receive names. When that comes, we still don't know. And then once we approve that, that's when emails and charges happen. And then we charge cards up till mid-June. Like it was mentioned, Utah's one of the friendliest states out there. And if you draw a permit, we want to make sure we give you plenty of opportunity to pay for that permit. It's kind of shocking that it can take 4 weeks to get payment, but it does. And we want to try to give people a chance to pay for that permit. And then once that happens, that's the draw, but in the end, it takes up to almost mid-July to finalize the draw, all said and done. So, in summary, there's dozens of crucial tasks necessary to prevent errors in the drawing. Like I said, I just kind of gave you a brief summary of the timeline. I didn't put every little detailed task because we would be here for another hour with me going through each task. But I wanted to highlight the major ones. As a division, our top priority is to make sure that this draw is 100% accurate. That is our main concern. We want to make sure whoever draws a permit is supposed to draw a permit and isn't on revocation or there's any errors. We want to make sure it's 100% accurate. But we all know that technology is advancing, and we believe this may help streamline the process. We are in process of looking at e-tagging. We just passed some legislation this year to allow us to start looking into e-tagging. And we're trying to develop a program so in the next year or two that may come forth with e-tagging. And we believe that will help streamline that so we can gather data and make recommendations quicker because the biologists would have that information quicker. And we're also looking for tech solutions to preserve the integrity and fairness of the draw and help reduce time that takes to review those applications. Each year, our applications are going up by 5%. So who knows if that keeps on that steady incline, who knows what will be in a couple of years from now. We don't know when it will hit that plateau, but if it keeps going up, you know, hopefully we don't hit 600,000, 700,000 apps. We just never know, but we want to look for solutions to reduce that time to review them, but still make sure it's accurate. So with that, we believe that keeping the application the same time frame is best for the division and best for the hunters that are applying. But we're also not dropping this. We want to look for, once these things come in place, we want to look and see if we can modify the application timeline so we can get, you know, quota into the hunters when they're applying, but not until we make some changes to technology. And with that, thank you.
Thank you, Lindy. Everybody shouldn't have any questions.
Do you have any questions? I'm happy to answer.
Do you have one, Dan?
Yeah, I was just curious. Do any other states that you know of have e-tagging in place?
They do, yeah. We are working with those states and communicating about, you know, how it's going for them, what they're seeing, and you know, what's working best and what's not working best. So There are some states that do it. They're more back east, though. Okay. So.
Okay, thank you. Okay, there's one more item. It's not our item, but I think we ought to go through it anyway. Just kidding. I will entertain a motion to adjourn.
Adjourned.
That was kind of a motion.
Hold on, we're not done yet. Sit down.
We're not done yet? That's the last item on there.
I know, but I need a second.
I second.
Oh, you really do? All right, and it's unanimous, by the way.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
You guys have crossed all our T's.
Serious, wasn't she?
Boy.